Dad? Hello, Jack.
I don't understand. You died.
Yeah. Yes, I did.
Then how are you here right now?
How are you here?
But this place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Crashed on this place by coincidence, especially this place. We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Where you go, Dutch?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episode 17, The End. And we saw a very important event in all space and time this week on Lost. But we didn't get a very key question about it answered, which is, what dish is served at the Driveshaft Widmore Benefit Concert? My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I think it's peanut butter cookies and bulletproof milk.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I'm going to go with Dr. Juliet Burke's Season 3 burger with a side of Mr. Cluck's chicken, courtesy of Hurley.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm thinking it's roasted boar, a throwback, and some Dharma wine that has been salvaged and is now vintage that is being served.
Ooh, salvaged vintage sideways Dharma wine.
Yeah, it's even got like the crusty label still on it, but you can still see the Dharma logo.
Nice. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. I completely understand wanting to start with the end, believe me, with my personal stance about knowing things, so totally get it. If you're returning with us to the island after being a longtime listener, welcome to the end of our rewatch of the ABC series Lost. Our podcast was and will be an ideal companion if you're rewatching the series again or visiting the island for the very first time, because each previous episode came in sections. There was a calm section that only discussed the preceding episodes, and then a second section called The Storm. This week, none of that applies, as there aren't any episodes of the show left to spoil, though there is a short called The New Man in Charge, so maybe watch that first if you're especially spoiler-averse. We will be talking you through it a bit here. If you like what you hear or have liked what you've heard and want access to our previous years of bonus content, you could sign up, of course, at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. We do have more Weeks of the Storm content coming for you in the month of September. Joanna, how can people participate?
Oh, you just don't unsubscribe from this feed.
And we'll
be doing a bunch of sort of Lost-centric wrap-up episodes through the month of September is our plan. So just hang tight. And if we could tell you what we're doing next, we absolutely would. So we would love for you to hang tight so that we can tell you what we're doing after we're done talking about Lost. So stay subscribed here. You can follow us on Twitter at StormPodcast. You can go to our website, stormpodcast.com. All of that will have some information for you. You could always email us, host@stormpodcast.com, to harass us about what we're doing next. We'd love to hear from you. We've got three primo emails that I am reading this week, but of course we have more emails than that, and of course we would love to hear even more than that. I think some people were a little reticent to send us finale emails because they thought we would get more, maybe, I don't know, would be my guess. So guess what? Good news. Hot Shots. Next week, we'll be doing a mailbag episode. So please send us your emails, thoughts, queries, frustrations, loves with the Lost finale. Like I said, we've got three great emails this week. I'm going to read one at the top of the show, and then the other two I'm going to read towards the end of our discussion because they're two really good assessments of the finale. One from someone who liked it and one from someone who didn't. But I think that they're both like really fair emails. So I think that will provide our fair and balanced coverage of Lost. But let us start with Alethea, who has an interesting question. She says, listening to you all talk about Kate's dress, agreed. It's too much Desmond, you sideways perv. It leads to this question. Why is she not wearing it in the church? As best I can tell, everyone's wearing the clothes we last saw them in except Charlie, Juliet, and Kate. I can explain away the first two. Charlie wakes up and realizes driveshaft stage attire is inappropriate for a moving on event in a church, so he gets something better from his suitcase, or he drags Claire and Aaron to his motel to pick something up. Okay. Juliet, while realizing the hospital break room is a purgatory, Bardo still has enough propriety to feel uncomfortable macking on Sawyer at her place of work. So they go back to her place and yada, 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 need to put their clothes back on. Sawyer's only got what he's wearing, but Juliet has a full closet from which to choose an appropriate moving on outfit. Apparently, you don't wear little black dresses to this thing. Where's David? No one cares. Not the point. Kate, though, she's in Jack's Jeep in her little black dress, and then Jack goes for his heart-to-heart with Christian and comes into the sanctuary, and Kate has changed. Did Desmond bring a second outfit? After Claire and Charlie woke up, there's that bit where Claire says to Desmond, now what? Did it cut away before we could see where she said, what have you got for me next? I'll need to get a new outfit. Did Penny bring it? thanks for leading us through this past few years. I didn't find y'all till quarantine, but it's been a sanity saver, Alethea. So, I thought this was a funny email. And I forgot that not only is Kate's dress ridiculous, but Claire's dress is way even more ridiculous for a pregnant lady. I just wanted to shout out the tiny dresses and how they're not, I guess, church appropriate.
I really like the version where it was Penny that brought this outfit this time, because it's, you know, it's not what Desmond would choose. And the top is green.
I was going to say it's a Christmas green color. Yeah, she's basically wearing like engineer pants from The Limited, which were very hot at the time, and nice green top. I vote Penny brought her. Mm-hmm. Penny showed up to the church, saw the little black dress, said BRB. We can do better, Desmond.
Yeah.
And comes back with that. So that's my guess. So email more emails like that or anything you want to email us. That would be great. We also got some reviews. We got a bunch of new reviews this week. And I'm going to start with a 1-star review.
Oh, God.
From Jilly, who says, doesn't work for me. Yeah, almost at the end of this podcast, and I keep trying, but I can't. Like, I appreciate Jilly for sticking with us for two years. Seriously.
Maybe this week I'll like this bullshit.
Almost at the end of this podcast, and I keep trying, but I can't do it. Why listen to people who really don't like the show? The three hosts continually talk about how they would change Lost, that they could do a better job of writing, producing the show. Although there have been some good discussion and some guests, mostly I get upset with their arrogance, their 2021 woken judgments of a 2004 series. Many people like them, but for me, it just doesn't work. I just want to save the record. I don't know that. I definitely don't think I could do a better job of writing or producing Lost. I just want to say that.
No, yeah. I don't think that's the... What I think we're doing is showing how the things that maybe we don't like might have been like the pressures of making television or something and not necessarily storytelling problems. But I could see how it comes off as us trying to fix it. And also, a lot of season 6, I'm pretty sure we've been like, what would be better than this? And that's a certain type of criticism. I get it. I get this person. I don't think I could do a better job making Lost.
No. 5 stars. This one comes from Angie, who says, come for the theory, stay for the friendship. A great companion to a first timer, but even better for a rewatcher. I love Lost when it aired and began slowly listening to this pod after Game of Thrones wrapped. Then it was March 2020 and a lot more time on my hands. I got caught up on the episodes and would anxiously await for the next one to catch up with my friends, Joe, Dave, and Neil. While Joanna and Dave's arguing sometimes feels like my mom and dad are fighting, Neil is the calming voice of reason who can make it all better. This show holds a special place in my heart, and so does this podcast. I love that idea that I'm like, I think I'm like shitty island god Jacob. And Dave is like empathetic, root-forable antagonist, the man in black. And Neil, I don't know, whatever you want to be, that's who you are, balancing the scales. So,
sure. I'm the guy who gets to be in charge at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like, you guys are being really ridiculous considering you can't hurt each other.
New rules. I'm in charge. All right, Danny, 5 stars, one of my favorites. I discovered this podcast through the extending Buffering the Vampire Slayer universe. Inspired me to finally watch Lost all the way through during the pandemic. I started by only listening to the spoiler-free comm section, but I eventually outpaced the podcast, finished the series, and then immediately listened to the whole podcast again, this time including The Storm. And I even joined the Patreon and the wonderful community of listeners on Slack. I love the vibe of this podcast, part critical analysis, part deep lore theorizing, and part goofy conversations among friends. And the hosts are starting to feel like old friends to me. I love listening to Joanna's passionate, insightful takes. Dave never fails to crack me up. Time, daddy! And I've developed quite the crush on Neil, the cool, calm sender who can always be relied on to break the tension when Joanna and Dave's debates heat up. I can't wait to hear what show they'll tackle next. Okay, Dave, we've been fighting too much, apparently. All right.
Great. Good. Here at the end, let there be one light and one dark.
Jeff Coop, 1787, says 5 stars, a great ride. Rewatching Lost with this. I'm reading them all because this is the end, so I'm just going to read them all. 5 stars, a great ride. Rewatching Lost with this podcast has been a great ride. The podcast isn't perfect, sure. The hosts sometimes get so wrapped up in the diversions and corners, they lose track of some truly important moments in the show. For example, they almost completely skip past my 2 favorite moments in season 5. What are they? Jeff doesn't say. I don't know what we skipped. Okay. But the commentary is largely thoughtful and insightful, as well as amusing. And Joanna's occasional interviews with members of the creative team are terrific. I wish there were more. This is the podcast I look forward to most every week. If that doesn't merit 5 stars, I'm not sure what would. Last but not least, from Deep D, 5 stars. Is this the best podcast ever? We've come so far from 1 stars. I'm excited and sad for the close of this podcast and the rewatching, revisiting of the series. I binged the first 5 seasons of this on Netflix, caught up to the final season, and watched it live. I had mixed feelings on this last season, but ultimately felt like the finale was emotionally satisfying. But in contrast, listening along with these fine humans has been a consistently joyful experience. Joanna, Neil, and Dave have been fabulous guys, exploring the show, revisiting all the mysteries, characters, and reexamining the context and creators behind it. If you want thoughtful conversations, analysis, and more, if for this or whatever storm the host chase next, give this podcast a follow. See you in the sideways. Hope it's Coco Van Night. DC. All right. So thank you guys so much for all your reviews ever across time. We appreciate all of them. And we appreciate you listening and we appreciate your feedback. So now, without further ado, and for the last time, I would like to ask Neil, what happened on Lost this week?
Oh, boy. Did a few things happen. This episode, The End, was written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse and directed by Jack Bender, all the big hitters for this one. It has the distinction of being the longest episode of the entire series at 104 minutes and 42 seconds. It aired as a single episode on May 23rd, 2010, and it takes place on day 14 following the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. On the aforementioned island, newly appointed island god Jack sets his plan into motion. He takes Kate and Hurley to the light cave while Sawyer heads to the well to collect Desmond. And when Sawyer arrives at the well, Desmond, of course, is not there, but he does have a quick chat with old Smokey and he gets a chance to punch Ben in the face one more time. We soon find out that Desmond was rescued by Rose and Bernard and Vincent, who are the real heroes here. And before they can send Des on his way, because they are not about that dramatic bullshit, Phlox shows up and threatens to murder everyone. To save Bernard and Rose from a horrible fate, Desmond agrees to do whatever it is that Phlox wants. Back in Dharmaville, Miles finds Richard, and they head for the Ajira plane with a backpack full of C4. Along the way, Richard gets his first gray hair. And as they're paddling out to Hydra Island, they pick up Frank, who is floating in the wreckage of the sub and immediately decide to steal the plane instead of blowing it up. Out in the jungle, teams Jack and Flock converge and agree to forge ahead together. When they reach the light cave, they lower Desmond down to the bottom, where he literally unplugs the island, causing the light to go out, the island to begin shaking, and the man in black to become mortal with a little, after, you know, a little blood. You guys get it. As the island shakes and the storm rages, Jack and Flock have an epic fight on the cliffs, and right as Jack is stabbed and seemingly about to die for nothing, Kate shows up and shoots the man in black with a bullet she saved just for him. In the wake of Flock's death, Hurley and Ben stay to help Jack save the island while Kate and Sawyer head for Hydra Island on the Elizabeth. And before Jack can climb into the light cave and sacrifice himself to save the island, he anoints Hurley as the island's protector by making him drink river water out of an oceanic water bottle. Once down in the cave, Jack helps Desmond get out before reinserting the island's cork. And as he's flashed away by a bright light, Jack realizes that he saved the island, leaving Hurley to find a better way to run things with Ben at his side. In the flash sideways, Kate tags along with Desmond as he runs his final set of errands, including signing for Christian Shepherd's casket at the church. Elsewhere, Hurley takes Saeed along as he kidnaps Charlie, drops him at the museum, and then heads to a bar where Shannon and Boone are caught in an alleyway scuffle. After saving Shannon and Boone, and Saeed and Shannon finally meet in the sideways, which wakes them both up. Back at the museum.
Wow, I really thought you were going to do it. I thought I was going to do it.
Back at the old museum, Miles spots Saeed, prompting him to have his partner James run over to the hospital to protect Sun, who they assume Saeed will go after because they assume he's the one that shot Sun. But as we know, that's not the case. At the hospital, Juliet shows up to perform an ultrasound on Sun, and they both wake up. Sun and Jin both wake up. Juliet then says hello to her fellow doctor, ex-husband, and baby daddy Jack before heading out to the big benefit concert, only to be called back to the hospital later for an emergency situation. At the benefit concert, Daniel Widmore performs on piano, accompanied by Driveshaft, just as Claire begins to go into labor. As Kate delivers the baby backstage, she is awakened in the sideways. And when Aaron finally arrives, it wakes up Claire and Charlie as well. Back at the hospital, John Locke awakens after a successful operation to find that he has sensation in his legs and memories of what happened in another life. It only kind of wakes up Jack, though, who rushes out of the room to go find his non-existent son. On his way out the door to the concert, Jack helps guide Detective Ford to the hospital vending machine, where he meets Juliet, and they both wake up over an Apollo bar, and literally everyone watching cries.
Wake me up inside, wake up, wake there we go. That was the one.
That's the big one.
Yeah. Then, later, with everyone waiting for him inside the church, Jack finally arrives to find his father's coffin. As he touches it, he is awakened to find his father standing there, ready to explain that the sideways is a gathering place for the most important people in his life. It's a place to remember and to let go before moving on together. The whole thing ends back on the island, where Jack has been transported out of the cave and back into the jungle. And as he lays down to die, Vincent shows up to snuggle, and a Jira Flight 316 flies overhead as his friends escape the island. Jack closes his eyes with the knowledge that his friends were able to leave the island safely. Fun fact about this episode, Elizabeth Mitchell, who's a big returning guest star for this one, filmed the hospital scenes on her birthday in the early hours of the morning. And there was a small celebration for her among the cast and crew. So that's lovely.
Apollo bars for everyone.
Yeah. this week's calm question. It's a very emotional, obviously, episode of television. So I actually went through and counted pretty much how many times I cried. So I'd like to ask you guys how many times you cried while we were watching this episode for prep. And I will be happy to go first and list off the 10 times in which I was brought to tears.
Well, can I just say, let me just go first really quickly, and it'll feed into yours, which is I looked at your list here, mm-hmm. and I cried for 8 of those. So I would guess 8 out of 10
nice.
Is me crying.
Nice. All right. So here are the 10. The first time Rose and Bernard show up, I just think that's great. Sun and Jin waking up after seeing Jiyeon on the ultrasound. Hurley and Saeed in the car, not necessarily her Saeed and Shannon, but Hurley is great there. Aaron's birth, of course, when John wakes up in the hospital. Kate and Jack saying goodbye on the cliffs. The vending machine, of course. We could just call it the vending machine scene. Then Hurley and Jack on the river water. And then Locke and Ben outside the church always kind of gets me. And then, of course, the entire 15 minutes, but none more than when Vincent shows up. I think that's when it really just kicks in and it's like, ah, shit, here it comes. So, all right. So those are my 10. Joanna, 8 out of 10. Dave, tell us about your emotions.
Well, first of all, I was drinking and didn't realize until this morning, I watched it last night, that all I'd eaten yesterday was like a stack of cheese, like Homer Simpson-esque, like one slice, two slice. So I don't really remember towards the end outside of like once we get to the church, it's just like moment after moment chaining into mm-hmm. one gigantic cry. So that's what I'm going to claim is the only time.
Did you cry?
A little bit.
I thought you were going to say zero. Oh,
no, weird. No. I definitely went out on the balcony because John can't see me cry.
The end, which I think another fun fact is that final act is like 17, almost 18 minutes long, which is the longest single act, like commercialless act of the entire series. It's just hit after hit after hit. It's like John and Ben outside the church, then Hurley and Ben, and then, of course, all the Jack and his father stuff is
it's really like the Jack and his father stuff
slash
too. The like most important people or the people you needed to move on. That's the stuff that hits differently in 2021 than when it first aired for me in 2010, because I wasn't like prepped for like this gigantic reveal of what half the plot of the final season of the series was. This time I like knew it was coming, but even when it hits, I think it's like when Jack realizes that he also died, everything from there on out feels much more personal. Just time helps. Time mm-hmm. and aging helps, which I guess a lot of people tried to tell me when I was young and 20 and popping off on a bunch of different things, but now I understand it.
I've said this in the storm before, but sometimes I just watch that sequence between Christian and Jack on YouTube from like I Died Too, and then if I just want to like cry, I don't remember what else I was gonna say. My overall, not that you asked me, but I'm gonna say it, my overall take after this particular time watching the finale, and I've rewatched the finale multiple times over the past couple of years, is that this last season and this finale is just so much better on a rewatch. It just really mm-hmm. is. And I'm excited to talk about why. But it really, really benefits from a rewatch. So
yeah. Well, I think we should just start with just talking about this as a finale, because as we've sort of been mentioning, I guess a lot in the storm, or no, a lot in the entire podcast, this wasn't something that television necessarily allowed its gigantic dramas to do, is to sort of end and to sort of end on its own terms. And so I think when we initially started this project, we kind of half picked Lost because we were coming to the end of Game of Thrones, and we thought it'd be fun to sort of like mash finales. And in a very, very specific way, rewatching this with like Game of Thrones in mind, there's so many things about it that make it smart choices, even if some of the lore gets like wishy-washy. But the idea that the whole flash sideways was a bardo, Joanna, for those of our listeners who've been in the calm, can you explain the like bardo concept?
So bardo is a concept from Eastern religion. I think it's like Tibetan Buddhism specifically. And it's this a sort of place between death and rebirth. you know, a purgatory-esque kind of place. But the idea, I think, of the Bardo is that, no, I mean, that's what I, like, it's a liminal, it's a purgatory. Like, how is it different from purgatory is my question.
Yeah, it's basically like a purgatory, I think, but you're not always aware that you're dead.
Right.
And you're living something to, like, learn a lesson, whereas purgatory is, like, some sort of waiting or punishment.
Yeah. Purgatory, as far as I understand it, having been raised Catholic, is more like a waiting room where you're waiting for the decision. Right. Whereas a Bardo, especially the way I think Lost constructs this Bardo, is it's sort of like a staging area before you move on to your next life. But there are like things to do. So like,
yeah, we'll get, a journey you have to go.
Yeah. On. And yeah. We have several characters in this episode who tell us that they're not done doing the things that mm-hmm. they needed to do in the Bardo. So yeah, it's more of a timeless staging area for souls before they, I guess, you know.
But then, I mean, the number one thing that I saw, and like we should say, well, a couple things. The new, I forget if you said this, and I think maybe you did, but I just want to make sure. Like I said, we're going to talk about The New Man in Charge, which was this like bonus content that was on the DVD. You can just find it on YouTube. You can just type New Man in Charge. Mm-hmm. There's two, I think it's two segments that you're going to want to watch. But maybe they're just back to back on YouTube. The other thing I wanted to say is like reading. Oh, we did an anniversary special of this podcast to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the finale. And, you know, which Neil heroically edited together. And we talked to like a bunch of folks who've been on the show at different times, you know, Emily Vandervoof, Alan Sepinwall, Miles McNutt, like all these critics, Mo Ryan, like all these folks who were covering the show at the time of their memories of the finale. And it's a really fun listen, I think, But what I, well, my main takeaway from that, these are the folks who were really in the trenches covering Lost, which I wasn't at the time, right? And my takeaway from that was like, they all thought the finale was great. And then the backlash sort of became evident like the next morning or whatever. But even though they all thought the finale was great, in reading all of their recaps, all of their reactions and stuff, a main critique they had of the season was like, we spent so much time tying ourselves in knots trying to figure out what this sideways was, that it's not like we're disappointed about what it is, but it felt distracting. That Easter egg hunt felt distracting. And I think that's what I mean by, if you rewatch it, knowing what it is, mm-hmm. knowing they're in a Bardo the whole time, you just relax and enjoy it. And that's why I think the final season especially is rewarding on a rewatch. So.
Yeah, yeah, I think all the episodes except for Kate's episode, which I think still on the rewatch is kind of like, eh.
Kate's, and I feel like there was another one. I think the Sawyer one, that's something I had in the notes because it's something I think Miles McNutt pointed out, which is like Kate and Claire and Sawyer have their big moment in this episode. And so their individual episodes are just kind of like their characters aren't making any movement. You know what I mean? Because
mm-hmm.
they don't make the movement until this episode, which is not how it had to be. Like, they found movement for Locke to do, even though he woke up in this episode. His episode with Helen is still very emotionally rewarding, but it just feels
they
like
gave Jack a whole son.
Yeah, it feels like, well, you can't give everyone a whole son in theory. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that it is true, and I think it was true in 2010 that the sideways, the first time through, there it feels like there's a lot of wheel spinning. And then you get to this finale and all of the things start happening. You know, everybody starts waking up and you have these hugely emotional moments. But on a rewatch, I think I've appreciated it even more because there are little details in there. There are points where, you know, we've talked about in Storm segments throughout season six, where it's like, is this character slightly awake? Is this character waking up? Or, you know, it's interesting to watch them move the pieces around knowing where the sort of end game is. So I think it is something, it's one of the things about Lost that's probably more rewarding on a rewatch than it would be the first time through, for sure.
Yeah.
And to yes and Dave's point, the Saeed episode, I think, is also just feels kind of like,
mm-hmm.
Yes. The Saeed six season problem, I think, remains. And, you know, is in this episode, but it overall, it does a lot of, like, really smart things. Like, even if we were to go back and conceive of a finale, knowing what we knew about today, not saying that we could do it any better. Like, the idea of basically, I think, Joanne, in the notes, you say it's like a clip show finale. That's, mm-hmm. like, genius, because sixth season Lost and first season Lost have very different flavors to them. And then each in season in between also has, like, a little dash of, like, Dharma or, like, others or, like, Freighter. And we get to selectively pick these based on character connections because of the whole conceit of them waking up. And it's really smart in hindsight. Like, even if there was a better way to plot do it instead of it being like a Bardo, just the idea of being able to call upon any relationship in the previous season and bring it back to sort of contribute to this idea of finality they're building to is just a really, really smart way to structure a finale. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Much well, better than like a denouement sort of thing, which I guess is how Game of Thrones kind of played.
Yeah, I honestly, I think that's probably the thing I like most about it is the way that it is so perfectly edited, and the fact that, you know, doing what is essentially a clip show allows you to finish off the emotional arcs of all these characters in a way that feels satisfying. Because I think that, you know, for all the problems, you know, structurally and some of the plot gaps that exist in season six, the thing that Lost does in the end, literally the episode called The End, is that it finishes emotional, like the emotional arcs all feel like they're complete and it was worth going on this ride. And I think that's, you know, the little flashes is to these moments that these characters had along the way. It allows you to not only be engaged with the story that is happening, but also to sort of wistfully remember the journey that we've been on, you know. And for us, it's been a 2-year rewatch. And for people who are watching at the time, it'd been, you know, full 6 years of watching Lost week to week. And, you know, I think that, you know, emotionally it lands. And that, in Lost's case, is more important than explaining all of the little mysteries that we've debated along the way.
I mean, you know? depends why you're watching the show, but
sure.
for why I watch the show, I would agree with you. And like, I think one critique I saw that I thought was interesting that I hadn't considered was like, because in the clip show aspect of the finale, they chose mostly really early season stuff, season one, season two stuff. You know, it gives us that nice nostalgia feel, which The Sideways has been giving us all season, right? When our old faves show mm-hmm. up. But one critique I saw was like, it could make you feel that the journey that they were on didn't matter past those early seasons. Like, if we're resetting these characters to their season one, season two spaces in The Sideways, which we kind of are, then like, what about their evolution since there? And I guess the argument back I would make is like, I think Ben is the prime example, I think, of something really interesting happening in this finale where we know for a fact, you know, like some people died, you know, Jack Shepard dies when the on-island plot wraps up in this episode, right? Mm-hmm. But Sawyer, Kate, Hurley, Ben, everyone on the plane, et cetera, they lived longer. Who knows how long, but they lived longer. And we know that Ben especially got to live out his redemption arc mostly after the episode wraps up as Hurley's number two. And there's this thing that Michael Emerson does when he's like talking to Jorge Garcia, when he's offering his assistance, offering advice, it's very Dr. Linus. It's not really Ben. It feels very Dr. Linus to me. And so that means that the person we're seeing in the Flash Sideways is not the Ben who's like still playing all sides, even up to the finale. Like last week I was wrong because I think I said something in the story about him being on a triple cross, but he wasn't. He was just like, oh, I get the island. Oh, I don't get the island. Fuck you. Like, I don't, mm-hmm. You know, Ben is still sort of like hopping where he needs to go right to the end. But then you believe him when he says he's going to help Hurley. And then we get confirmation that he did help Hurley. And so that's where Ben's development is. And that's something we don't get to see. But everyone else, it feels like, you know, what happened with Kate afterwards? We can speculate, but like, is she still going to show up in the flash sideways and not be changed by those years she spent like raising Aaron and doing whatever else, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting question to me.
Yeah, well, and I think this leads down a lot of folks to the idea that this version of the Bardo is like specifically Jack's Bardo, right?
It's and then, complicated.
And then that's where it gets complicated, because then it's like, does everyone have their own Bardo? Is this just Jack, or is this all of these people? I think the show wants us to believe that this is this group of people, but that's where it gets kind of weird.
It can't be just Jack because of Eloise specifically, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Among other things. Like, I think it would, if they had said it was just Jack, it would make so much more sense. In terms of like who's there and who's not there, stuff like that. But like, you cannot convince me any day of the week that Rose and Bernard would be like, yep, these assholes who we avoided on an island for literally years are who we want to go on
with. Well, I mean, unless Rose and Bernard just lived out their lives on the, I mean, I assume they just lived out their lives on the island. So they may not have met very many more people in their lives.
Fair. I don't know. What do you think, Dave?
I like the idea of there being multiple Bardos, but like, you kind of don't care because you're in the afterlife, and in each one you're summoned to, you're meeting more people you love, which I think we might have come to a conclusion on like a past storm just to make us feel better, but it still makes me feel better, where it's just like, yeah, I'm going to show up in some people's Bardos when I die. You know, that's great. We're going to have the Storm podcast Bardo, but I also get to, you know, like, have my mom and like family members in a different Bardo.
Cause that your mom's like that definitely happen. In the Storm podcast Bardo. By the way,
she could be in multiple Bardos too. I just, everybody,
Kevin gets to come too.
Sure.
Kevin also gets to come. So then it's like, it feels like, you know, there could be enough Venn diagram Bardos. Just every once in a while you're living a Bardo. And then when you move on, you move on. It's timeless. So we could apply those rules. And then that way we don't have to worry about poor Aaron, who like met all of his important people when he was a child.
Yeah, listen, I mean, like, there's things that don't make sense when you drill down, and they'll never make sense, because I promise we've been talking about them in the storm for 2 years. Like, why is Aaron a baby? Is Jian like a fetus in her afterlife, or does she not? I mean, if I were Jian, I would not want to be in a Bardo with my parents who decided to die on a submarine instead of come back to me.
Yeah, I would spend the rest of my life pretty pissed off about that.
Yeah, but like, there are some questions. Also, like, why do they all look like they did the last time Jack saw them alive? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's there's questions like that that would make the most sense if this were just Jack's Bardos. But there's other things that sort of
why is Christian Shepherd a complete stranger to most of these people, opening the door for all of them?
Did you see that note in the Lostpedia that there was supposed to be like a new character opening the door?
The
for
minister.
All of them? Oh, wow.
I'm so much happier. It's Christian Shepherd.
Yeah, that kind of would have played like as a big fuck you at the end if it was just like, and the character that opens the door. So it'd be like, what, is that God? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, at least we get the line where Kate makes fun of the name Christian Shepherd in the finale.
Yeah, no, that's like one of the early lines. It's like bold first step finale. Just make fun of the, just like get a shot at J.J. Abrams in right at the beginning. You named him Christian Shepherd and Jack Shepherd, did you?
But yeah, it's, I like, we should talk about the number one thing that we often come back to in the storm, which is why the fuck is Shannon in the church? We've gotten some good emails about this, some interesting emails about this, but mostly I think it has to be just like, we want to do as many people who are on the plane in the church sort of thing.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny because you mentioned that everybody looks the same as when Jack last saw them. That is, it's another thing that sort of goes to this being like a Jack specifically tailored Bardo situation, where it's like Jack's only memory of Saeed's love life is that Shannon was there.
Though Jack did see Aaron as a toddler. So
that's true. That's true.
Oh yeah, but he doesn't want to remember any of that.
Maybe the Vicodin that was all horrible. where do you guys land? So I've been sort of banging the drum about the last season being like a Jack redemption season. Mm-hmm. I still feel that way. I know from our last live watch that there are still plenty of people who are not enjoying Jack in any shape or form. And to them, I say, at least you get to watch him die for a really long time. But where are you guys sitting with the Jack final season redemption arc movement stuff?
He does really good in this episode. Because first of all, he steps right out and continues doing the thing he did with Sawyer last week, which is just admitting when he doesn't know what he's talking about, which is basically what I want, bare minimum what I wanted from Jack all along. So great, he's moved on there. And then the rest of his motions are just confident ones, and I also like that for him. And then he like makes a sacrifice and is like really like on board, truthful with his self-bedside manner, saying goodbye to Kate. I think, at least in this episode, it really works for me. Season-long, it does sort of seem like he stared out at the ocean by the lighthouse and became a better character. But I don't hold that against the show at all, because it lands the planes, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that, you know, season long, it lands because it pays off so well, right? Like, I don't know if all of the Jack stuff that we've gone through in six seasons or even in the most recent season would be worth it if it didn't land. But I think it's important that it lands both in his on-island story, which I think is great. You know, he has finally found what he's actually there for, and he's right this time. And he saves everyone, and that's great. But even in, I think there's a really good element to sort of the way the Flash Sideways ends right before they get to the church. Like, you have this moment where he meets Kate and he's started to wake up just a little bit, but he's not quite all the way there. And he has to make this choice to just go with her on faith, right? And that is a choice that I don't think season one Jack would make, to just follow someone to a church on
abandon
faith.
His wife and child and
sure
follow this
to give up on
this weird dress,
his non-existent son. But I think that there's a calmness to the way Matthew Fox exists in those moments, where it does feel like we've got the final version of Jack, right? Like, it feels like it matches the Jack that is handing over the island control to Hurley and accepting his fate, that he knows, you know, he's not going to make it out of this. So I think that really contributes, that nice parallel in tone, especially in the way his performance plays out, is one of the reasons why it lands so well. And the fact that it lands so well matters in a huge way, because it makes a lot of the other stuff in season six sort of makes sense. And even going back to the time travel season, where we start to see Jack give up control, and he's a very chill dude at the end. He's also just very, very bloody on the island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His Bardo personality is much more willing to like give in to the supernatural than his season one personality would be. So it's kind of great. Like, there's a world where Jack taking until he gets to the church to wake up would have frustrated me, because that is just withholding information from the audience and from the character. And like, several times, Locke tries, Kate tries, finally it's touching his dad's coffin that like gets him going. I'm not annoyed by that, because it's not a Jack who's resisting it. It's a Jack who's leaning into it and who's following some sort of faith, which was kind of his like big problem in the first place, was his need to control and fix.
I also love it, but I disagree slightly, because I do think it's a Jack resisting it, because I and a reason why is he, unlike in the exact opposite of what he's saying on the island when he's like, I've ruined everything else. This is the only thing I haven't ruined, my chance to be this like island martyr, right? And I think Jack detractors will probably roll their eyes at him. Like, there's one cut from him to like the statue of Christ the Redeemer. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of stuff in this episode. There's also some great stuff from him when he's like, when Desmond's like, you were right, and Jack's like, first time for everything, you know, or when he says a thing to the Man in Black about how wearing John's face is disrespects him and stuff like that. Like, all that stuff is great Jack stuff. But I do think, as opposed to the man who has nothing left to live for, he thinks, on the island, in the Bardo, he's got this son. And like, mm-hmm. I think that's, unlike other people, that's what he's holding on to, is this like, I get to be a dad, Jack. And yeah. So when he is, I think, actively resisting the first two attempts to wake him up, and eventually has to let go and move on.
Yeah. You know? Well, I kind of find it funny, especially in rewatching this, because it's like everyone else, especially as we get down in this episode to the sort of what feels like rapid fire, people waking up all over the place. The fact that Jack is the last one is not surprising, right? Because there's a little bit of the old Jack in there. But, you know, I definitely think that we can see the change that he's made over the course of six seasons, for sure.
And I think Matthew Fox's performance is really incredible in moments. I mean, like the conversation we discussed with Christian, for sure. And also another thing that you guys have referenced a couple of times, which is Jack and Kate's goodbye on the island, which mm-hmm. is so surprisingly touching given how obnoxious the love triangle has been over the course of the series. But the way those two actors play that goodbye, you know, and the I love you. I mean, I'm not even remotely a Jack and Kate shipper, and I'm just sort of really touched by that moment. I think it's really beautiful. So mm-hmm. shout out to the performances, you know, incredible stuff.
Yeah. Also good writing there. Just like the, am I going to see you again? And Jack can't lie. He's a doctor and he knows he got stabbed under the ribs. He mm-hmm. knows how this goes somehow, even though in theory he might be immortal. I don't know how island godding really works.
Is it only you're only immortal if you decide that you're immortal? Or?
Well, if he recorks and decides he's immortal, well, I guess at that point he'd already passed it on to her. So he was screwed. But again, if there was a rule book or an org chart, I think a lot of this could have been avoided.
I bet that was Hurley's first thing. He put together an org chart because he already had.
Delegations happening.
Yeah, he's like, Ben's number two. Desmond is a temporary number three until we can find a way to get him off the island and back to his family. Rose and Bernard are, you know, they get to be on their own separate part of the org chart. We're not going to bother them. It's great. I think Hurley, that's why he was such a great man in charge later.
I don't want to completely become a fan fiction podcast, but what if you put Rose and Bernard by the light? So like, then no one fucks with them, right? Because it's magically hidden, and you got like this backup protecting the cork.
Love it. I mean, but that, I think that's still too close to the nonsense, posthumous white man nonsense for Rose and Bernard. To be honest with
fair
you.
Enough. Fair enough.
No, you know, they could just teach Vincent to go check on the light like once a day.
Vincent. Go check on the light.
Yeah. Let us know, Lassie, if anybody falls down the cave.
I will say that the show gets so much goodwill. Like, for all the Jack bullshit. Like I think the show gets a lot of goodwill for the fact that ultimately the correct choice for Island God is Hurley. Because of course mm-hmm. it is, but like there's a different version of the show where, you know, Jack stays Island God. That's a way less appealing version of the show. But the fact that it's Hurley, the fact that Jack is giving up his control of that, I think, you know, matters a lot.
Well, yeah, because it's, you know, it's a satisfying ending for both characters. You know, Jack, I mean, not that Jack dies, although I'm sure there are plenty of people that enjoy watching Jack die over and over again. But it's also for Hurley, because we've watched him ever since the ping pong on the beach, dabble in being the leader on this. And also I think it fits with Hurley was the one of the Oceanic Six that realized that that seemed to be better on the island, right? Or happier on the island. And when they left the island the first time, his life went really poorly. Like, he didn't have a good time and really seemed to thrive when he got back on the island and started taking a little bit of charge. So it's just, I don't know. I love it for Hurley. I love it for the audience. I love it for the show. I love it for all of us.
It's like obvious, but surprising at the same time.
Right. Yeah. Because I think, you know, especially back when this was airing the first time, people had to spend a week. It makes the decision to have Jack become the island god in last week's episode even smarter, I think, because it sets up the expectation with the audience that, oh man, what if this ends and Jack is the island god? Are you kidding me? So then it's a lovely surprise that it ends up being Hurley, you know?
I do think it's interesting how the ritual has deteriorated from like whatever it was that the mother started with to like Jack just like scoops some muddy puddle water into a shitty Ajira water bottle. Doesn't even say any words. Jacob at least said some words. And mm-hmm. He's just like, here you go. Now you're like me.
Yeah. No Latin. Jack's like Jack's like, my one and only day is island god. And I'm going to kill the smoke monster and ban Latin.
But it's the opposite of what happened with Bran on Game of Thrones. We promised we were going to be like comparing, right, the Thrones finale and this. Mm-hmm. And like the whole thing about the Thrones finale is Tyrion has to give this big speech as to why Bran is the obvious answer. And we were all like, what?
Why is Bran the obvious? I still don't get it.
And meanwhile, Jack's just like, it has to be you. And we're all like, yes, it does have to be her. Like, mm-hmm. no speech required. Yes, yeah, of course. Obviously, it's early.
Yeah, I mean, they've been setting it up for several seasons, it feels like. I do wonder when they knew, and I assume that it could have been as early as like when they decided on when the you know, how many seasons the show would end. That was what, back in season three, four?
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it's possible they would have known that Hurley would have ended up. But it does feel satisfying because it feels like they were planting that further back than the beginning of the final season, which even in the most generous read, the earliest Game of Thrones was planting the seeds of Bran being king was in the final season, which was a short one. So it really snuck up on a lot of people.
Why do you think I came all this way? Something I was remembering is like, I know that they didn't know, but like, you know how you really know they didn't know? Is they were like, sure, this is the character we can give a season off. Bye, Isaac Hempstead, right? No need to spend more episodes with you. Surely you won't
come
be
back
important
when you're
in
4 feet
run.
Taller.
Oh my god.
Come back for your extreme power ramp to god being, and sure, then we'll just get on with it.
If you're interested in seeing how Jorge Garcia reacted to learning that, like, because we should say there was so much secrecy around this finale. They did a lot of decoy stuff. There were like Santa Rosa Institute vans in the parking lot of the church. Apparently they
hired a Sun lookalike to walk around in a wedding dress.
To dress like a bride. They pretended it was Sun and Jin's wedding or whatever. And they Xeroxed the pages of the script on red pieces of paper, which means you can't then Xerox the red piece mm-hmm. of paper. The Xerox machine won't read it. Anyway, and they like delivered. Anyway, point being, there's a great YouTube video all about the delivery of the final scripts, and you can see Jorge Garcia reading the final scripts and finding out that Hurley is the guy, right? You can find that on YouTube. And then also we talked to Jorge Garcia in the first season, and also for that finale recap episode about how he reacted to finding out that Hurley was the guy, which is just mm-hmm. really sweet.
Yeah, and it's the exact opposite of those videos we saw of the Game of Thrones cast reading the final
slumping
season
in their chair.
So there you go. There's the comparison. It's what the people that made it thought. And, you know, the people who made Lost were a lot happier about what they did.
Yeah, and it feels momentous. Like, this finale is, because of how much it has to fit in, even though it is a very long episode, it kind of plays the hits after, not plays the hits, plays the hits and is all climax after the one throwaway scene, which is Sawyer going to the well and then Ben and Locke. And I think that just exists to recontextualize why Ben's with Locke, as Joanna, mm-hmm. you pointed out. And to get to, there's a dog here, which is their immediate way out of the scene. But everything else on Island
is
pretty great.
Not to mention it provides one more opportunity for Michael Emerson to be punched in the face.
That's true.
Which is, as we've discussed, perhaps one of the great things about Lost is how much Michael Emerson's face gets punchified over the course of six seasons.
I love how he turns up to the church, though, when he doesn't have the bruises anymore. Like,
sure.
Once he wakes up, he's like, oh, I can just zippity-zap these bruises off my face. Fun fact.
He's like, that's why I want to stay here in the Bardo, because no one's punching me in the face. I can work out my emotional
anymore.
Issues.
Anymore.
Once you all move on, no one's going to be punching me anymore.
I want to just stay here and live another couple of months where no one could punch me in the face. Thank you.
I also was like, why does this Sawyer scene exist? Because he runs in and runs back out. But he also does give the pertinent information that there is a new Island God, right? He tells Black that.
So that when they finally crest over the same hill, it's all score. And
so it's you. Kate. Yeah. Kate is so good in this episode. Is she not?
Kate is really good in this episode. I forget when I think back on this episode that she shot through all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just pretty great.
Yeah. Well, and I think that there's a lot of great quotable moments in this, but I Saved You a Bullet is really up there on rewatch. Like it was well planted and it's well paid off. And I appreciate that.
Comparing again to Thrones, which once again was the original prompt. And sorry if you've listened to this and haven't watched Thrones. We speak Game of Thrones podcast. Remember how people were like uptight about Arya killing the Night King? And like there was a little bit of like misogyny laced in there. But also it just felt like such a weird moment to just have Jon Snow like pinned against a corner. But I was like comparing this. I was like, Kate shoots him. And then Jack gives him the old kicker over the cliff. 1-2 putt. Great. This is what people wanted. They wanted like
teamwork.
Arya and Jon working together. And like, there's nothing to say that Arya can't kill the Night King by herself. Kate could kill the Man in Black by herself. It's all fine. But I like the teamwork makes the dream work aspect of what Kate and Jack will offer.
There's sort of an unceremonious end to it, right? Like it because there's so much episode left after the Man in Black is killed. I think that it's like, it's a good quick moment where like they use teamwork to defeat this guy. And then now we still have to deal with the bigger problem, which is the island is falling apart. Whereas, you know, the Arya moment sort of ends that episode and is given, you know, based on the way that the show is structured, is given a lot more weight than what we get here. But no, I love that it's Kate and I love that she gets a good quip in at the end and, you know, it's pretty great.
She's very consistent this episode, you know, making use of the walkie-talkie, getting everybody organized, taking the dive off the cliff first, because like Hurley's like, I'm not gonna climb down those rickety ladders, and I'm like, yeah, Sawyer can't even climb down those rickety ladders. How's this gonna happen? I forgot that the show was like, oh, it's the finale. Let's get some high jumps in here. We're on an island.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we're jumping? Let's go.
Yeah, right. Let's just do it.
That looked so scary.
It did.
Like I was
when
like,
Kate
whoever,
did it, I'm like, you don't know how deep that is.
And then like, Sawyer whoever, dives head first, and it's like, oh my God, what are you doing?
He goes in so close to the rocks. I was just like, who are these stunt doubles? Give them extra pineapple at craft services today. Jesus.
He did that in jeans.
Yep.
So yeah, while we're at the final battle, let's stick around there. Why not snake our way through the episode? This has a banner moment in Lost history where Jack just screams Locke and runs at him and then does like this leaping downward punch to commercial break. Very notable.
Mm-hmm.
Very notable indeed. But I do
it was also famously in the commercials or trailers leading up to the final episode, right? Do you guys remember this?
No, I don't.
Where it was like, that was the end of the trailer for this episode. And no one knew sort of when it happened. It's the end of part one. So it's like halfway through the finale. But I just very vividly not only remember seeing that, but then the fact that it cut to commercial is amazing.
And for a episode that won an Emmy for editing, it does let him get way too far into punching downwards to be a good mid-air punch cut to me. But still,
well, nowadays it would be they would keep the wide shot, right? And it would be them jumping at each other, but in slow motion. And then it would cut to the commercials.
Yeah, but, just completely break format for the finale splash page. Yeah.
Zack Snyder had only just broken onto the scene in 2010. So
it was a different world back then. A pre Batman v Superman worlds.
We love the Falcon Punch.
We love the Falcon Punch.
Falcon Punch. Yeah. But this was the battle that I believe initially they pictured happening on the edge of a volcano. But I think it still works really well on those terrifying cliffs that we were established in the cave episode, and with the boat out there. If this had happened volcano wise, do you think this would have been like a battle by the heart of the island?
I mean, we have people who are listening for the first time who have no idea that there was supposed to be a volcano, right?
Oh, there was supposed to be a volcano, which is why way back in the Dharma flashback episodes, they're talking about an active volcano on the island. This is before they knew necessarily how they were going to end the series. But by the time they got there, the volcano had just become the seismic activity as pictured, which does have some pretty good crumbling island shots from a distance for a 2010 television CGI, but it's not a volcano.
Yeah, I mean, if it was going to be the volcano, they would have needed to introduce more of it, I think, especially in this final season. I like that it ends up being a location that we've been to before, but not often. Like, I think it's
the cliffs with the ladder.
The cliffs. Yeah. I mean, we've only been to the ladder really in that one episode, but we've also sort of seen some of these cliffs in some of the earlier seasons when they're sort of traveling around the island. They can never see the ladders there, but you know, they weren't ready for those yet. But I like that it happens in a familiar place. If they would have just like tossed it in a volcano, I mean, I do like the idea, don't get me wrong, of when they unplug the island, the volcano erupts. Like, what? That feels like a much bigger, scarier version of what happens. But I kind of like that it's just sort of in a place that's familiar, and it's more about these two guys, mostly Jack, trying to save all his friends.
The idea would have been, I believe, according to this this article that Jeff Jensen wrote on Entertainment Weekly about the volcano thing, is that it would have been a volcano instead of the Cave of Light. So they talked about how they really wanted to, like, you know, if we're on an island, let's do Hawaii Island based sort of things, and what would make the most sense for like a smoke monster origin location on a tropical island than a volcano. And Lindelof gave this quote where he says, "It would be visually stunning and really exciting for the audience. After 6 years and around 121 hours of the show, we had shot literally every part of Oahu that we could for island scenes and flashbacks. So the idea that for the finale, we go to this new locale that's going to look new and different and unique, primal and ancient and end of worldish, that would be great." We got an email from a listener named Eric who says, and I think the lore is that they spent too much money on the temple or something like that. I don't know. There were some budgetary...
another thing that the temple ruined.
Questions at the end here. But Eric wrote into us and said, does the intended erupting volcano lore, the finale, impact your interpretation of the Cave of Light finale lore we got? Would it be better as originally conceived? To me, the mythology of the finale makes a lot of sense in the context of the creators fanboying over the Dark Tower, a universal nexus that, if destroyed, will release elemental chaos into the world. Why not literally just make it a cave of bright light instead of low-budget Mustafar? To me, this is the brash and bold absurd reality that Damon has become increasingly comfortable embracing in his later work. For the record, I love the ridiculousness of the literal quirk, The End of the Dark Tower is often criticized for the same reasons. There's probably no truly satisfying physical representation of this mythological idea, so the payoff will never be as exciting as the premise. Still, if you're tasked with writing the payoff, isn't it fun to literally make it a big stone cork that the unbuttoned EM electromagnetic hunk needs to move around? I sure can't think of a more fun alternative. Anywho, thanks for reopening the circle of loss for me, Eric. So, yeah, just some little volcano stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like that they tried to make the whole Desmond thing work in the end. I'm not sure they accomplished it, but the fact that Desmond is there and had to be down a well for most of the season, very silly. But I'm okay with it being a smaller scale thing because that felt right for what Lost had always been. You know, Lost wasn't – there's plenty of good and bad polygons along the way, but Lost was never – a show that relied heavily on, you know, blowing us out of the water with effects like Thrones tried to, and in many cases did. So yeah, the fact that the answer is, you know, a small weird cave that no one has, is able to see unless they're the, you know, chosen island god. I think that's kind of fun.
I mean, I like the idea of the cave, but also, like, they didn't necessarily go small because that is a full-ass set.
That's
with
true.
Water effects and lighting effects. And, like, that someone has to get lowered into it with
and
a light visual effect.
An actual stone cork.
And an actual stone cork. With
cuneiform on it.
Cuneiform. Yeah, I've been wrong saying it was Egyptian, but cuneiform. So even, like... who knows when that cork happened? Apparently, the people who installed it might have died there because there are skeletons down there.
There are skeletons down there. Here's one thing that I have to say with my whole heart. If I had to pick one thing to exile from the finale, it's not the cork. It's Daniel Faraday's hat. The end.
Yanked back into the sideways.
No. We can stay in the island. I just wanted to make sure I... talked about how much I hated the hat and that it was back. Okay.
Well, I mean, we could stick there for a little bit because our time daddy does get to meet his Charlotte in Sideways, which is nice for him. Even though he seems partially awake, he is not ready to move on definitely. Nor is Eloise. As we learned, or I guess as I learned on Lostpedia, initially, there was supposed to be a little bit more between Desmond and Eloise about Desmond talking about knowing what it's like to be a parent and sort of connecting them. Joanna, what is Eloise up to?
Okay, so if this isn't just Jack Sparrow, which it would appear it's not, then Eloise is like, please don't take my child with you in your church. I would like him in my church. Mm-hmm. And
well, the funny thing is that it's called Eloise's church because that's the church that we'd met her in. And anyway, sorry.
I don't think it's the same church, is it?
I think it is, where she has a conversation with Ben.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't there a Dharma station underneath that church?
The lighthouse, right?
Yeah.
Or the lamppost, sorry, the lamppost. Yeah, so she's like, I want him in my Bardo, not your Bardo, you sons of bitches. So I'll keep the hot redhead here so I can keep my son here.
If that's what makes him happy.
So he can keep playing truly shitty benefit concerts with other middling one-hit wonder rock bands. I don't know, Eloise is trying to like, she's trying to do a David Shepherd, only her son's a real guy and not star stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think she's still being a bad mom. That's what I think Eloise is doing.
Yeah. Well, I think this also makes me realize that it really sucks for Charlie's brother, who totally gets left behind and is not in the church.
But is
in the band.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think this is necessarily bad on Eloise's side because that's her thing that she needs to get over. Her entire life was that she couldn't do anything nice for her son because she knew exactly what her son needed to do. So now she just wants to spend some time doing, make sure he has everything he wants.
But she's not letting him make that decision.
Sure. Well yeah, here's the question. Fair. Because Daniel is one of the candidates, in my mind, for people that are not entirely asleep this whole time. Because he has that conversation earlier in the season where it seems like Daniel's kind of awake. And then you get his reaction to Charlotte here. And it also seems like he's kind of awake. So I think it's like in my mind, Eloise is trying to keep Daniel there, but Daniel is knowingly playing along because he also has some unfinished business. Because remember when Charlotte died abruptly and then he was killed by his own mother not long after? So I think it's like they have the most unfinished stuff to do in whatever this version of their Bardo is, you know?
Yeah, I think the key players, if I had to guess, would be Jack, obviously, Jack-centric Bardo. There's probably a Daniel-centric Bardo, because that would also include, like, Widmore.
And Miles.
Daddy Widmore and Miles. And
maybe
then,
even Frank. I don't know. Frank can be there.
Yeah, I think Frank was supposed to just be there.
Freighter
the
Bardo.
Yeah.
Freighter Bardo.
Is Minkowski there?
Minkowski's there. I mean, this is where all the
Zoe
freighter
Bell's
crew ends
there.
Up.
And then Ben. Ben has to be the third one because Danielle and Alex sort of split off there. And he would manifest those people. We had a really great email in the storm talking about how when it's Christian in this episode tells Jack this is a place that they all made. And so the idea that you put in something to tempt you that's either like good or bad. So the ultimate goal is like find each other and move on, but Jack gets to manifest David and Helen gets to be manifested for John. It's not actually Helen necessarily.
Right. That some of these people are star stuff, but we don't know. Right. And it's hard to know. Like David Shepherd feels like the most star stuffy sort of thing that we meet. But like, is Helen just in her own Bardo and she's just tangentially touching John's Bardo or whatever? We don't really know.
Mm-hmm. He went off to get that surgery and I never saw him again.
I mean, the stuff with David Shepherd, I love David Shepherd, but the stuff with David Shepherd in this episode is so weird because Locke is like, you don't have a son, which is a fucked up thing to say. It's a weird moment, right? Mm-hmm. And then Jack shows up to the party being like, I'm looking for my son. And then that's the last anyone here is a star stuff David.
Right.
You know,
yes,
dissolve into sparkles because both of his parents have gone to the church of moving on, you know?
And his mom is dating a cop now. It's wild. Yeah. She goes to the church with a dude named Sawyer.
I mean, if David is something like Jack's, like a childhood Jack who needs to forgive his dad, and Jack needs to live both sides of that by being the dad that is forgiven while also forgiving his dad, then I think David would cease to exist when Jack realizes he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why, in that sort of vein, if Helen isn't real and part of somebody else's Bardo, Helen would cease to exist when John.
So what you're saying is
surgery.
Like bad dadness is a flat circle.
But
that
isn't
Jack
it a
needs to deal with.
Isn't it a mistake to make David like a nice kid who we like? And so we're kind of like bummed that he just evaporates. Like, you know, if we were to cut to him after John, like half weeks, Jack, like, is he back to the futuring? Is he missing a hand and then like a leg? And then, you know what I mean? Like what's happening?
There's a couple of times in this episode where they could have a body dissolve and I'd be like, yeah, okay, cool. Like obviously everybody in the sideways, but also like there's a time after Locke's body falls down and we look down and Locke is definitely dead, or Man in Black is definitely dead, and then they have like a little talk and then Sawyer looks down and we see the body again, and I'm like, wouldn't it make so much more mythological sense if that body dissolved? Like, yes, show the body because you have to, television rules, so we know that he's dead, but also he's a smoke monster. Like, that's not John Locke's body. John Locke's body is buried in the graveyard, you know, somewhere else. And the Man in Black's body is in the caves next to his not mom. So this like mysterious new manifested body could have just gone into smoke and I would have been like, ah, yes.
Yeah.
A good dusting. David could have also been dusted.
I was going to say, very Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I guess very Avengers as well, but very Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I would have gone for it. So we have Eloise, we have the Widmores, we have a very assured Desmond, which is, I think, I want to talk about how this episode tries to hide its twist up until the very end, which I think it does successfully, less so on a rewatch because you know the twist. But There's specifically when Locke is talking about destroying the island and pulling out the cork, he says to Ben, this island's going to be at the bottom of the ocean, which is the first thing we saw in LA SpaceX at the beginning of the season. So when that happens and you're still in part one of a two-part finale, you're like, oh, are we seeing the result of the bad guy winning? I think a great use of tension there. And then there's the misdirect with Desmond, who thinks he knows what's going on. He's going to be lowered down into the cave. He's going to get pushed into this other dimension because Desmond, I don't think, really grasps what it is there. But because the rules don't apply to him, he gets to like see his death a little bit more. And he, you know, yells no and passes out weirdly after he does not enter the light, but instead depowers the island. Did those Mr. X work for you on a structural level?
The Desmond being convinced of something and being wrong doesn't really feel great to me, honestly. Him being like, I can take you somewhere and we'll go and everyone will be happy and we never came here. I was on the Oceanic flight with you. Like, it's I don't love that part, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what it does is it creates sort of an inconsistency between, like, because our conception of Desmond is that he has sort of knowledge of both those sideways and the main timeline, to the point where, you know, he's convinced that none of it matters because he's already dead or something like that. I don't have a problem with him being wrong, but I do see the in, like, it feels weird that sideways Desmond seems to have a very good grasp of what's going on in the sideways, and then Island Desmond is completely wrong. But I do like that Desmond survives and gets to go live his life, you know, gets to go back to Penny and Baby Charlie, who is also not in the church, by the way, just to add to the list of people who probably should have been in the church.
Well, you also assume Desmond survives. We don't actually have any canonical information.
I believe in Hurley. I believe that Hurley would have gotten Desmond home.
Yeah, after his temporary Force number 3 status you bestowed upon him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We do see him just like fully face down, and Ben's like, well, Desmond's going to be fine.
It's going to be fine. He's face down in the river water that's about to be repopulating. Maybe we should roll him over.
Don't worry about him. He's arced out. It's fine.
He's fine. It's fine.
I saw him in the church. It was fine.
I think it works well because, like, up until all the waking up really come, like, basically up until the church, when there is a scene where Christian Shepherd has to explain it to you, there's several times during the episode where you're like, is this another dimension? Because I think in the strongest tie of this finale to the premiere and maybe the emotional climax of the series is Sawyer and Juliet meeting and us realizing that Juliet was living that moment,
right,
down in the Dharma hole at the, mm-hmm, in this season premiere.
We can go Dutch, yeah.
And she's like, it worked. And there it was presented to us as an alternate reality. So even up until the church, I don't know that I could have safely guessed that they were dead. I think it's a deft way of working it.
Unless you're on the bandwagon of they were dead the whole time.
Unless you're on the bandwagon of they were dead the whole time.
Hey, guess what? That's wrong. I feel like there are people out there that have not watched Lost, or folks that watched this episode without watching a bunch of the rest of the stuff who still think that they were dead the whole time, which is all-time frustrating.
Well, that's something we should talk about in terms of, this is something that we talked about in the anniversary episode, and we've talked about a little bit in the storm, but something I was unaware of is this idea is that Lost had massive ratings up through the first 6 episodes of season 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a dramatic drop-off. Or I think there was a dramatic drop-off between season 2 and season 3, and then an even more dramatic drop-off after those first 6 episodes. So once again, to compare and contrast to Thrones is a show that just built and built and built and built in its audience, and Lost, you know, got kind of dramatically smaller, but out of sheer curiosity, a bunch of people tuned in just for the finale to be like, well, let's see how the show all ends, the show that I invested a couple years in, and I've read some stuff, I'm all caught up, I can watch it.
They missed the entire time travel season.
And those people especially I think we're prone to believe they were dead the whole time. Even though Christian Shepherd says it was real, it was all real, it all happened. Mm-hmm.
Well, and he points out that some died before Jack died, and some died long after Jack died.
Yeah, you know? He says Christian could not have said it plainer. But there's the ratings issue, and then the other issue that, of course, we want to talk about is this idea that, like, ABC made the decision to put footage of the fuselage over the closing credits that confused people and made them think that we were just back at the plane crash at the beginning of the season and series, and they were dead the whole time. And, that's not what was going on.
Yeah. Well, and the truth is that ABC put that there because they wanted sort of just like a soft transition. Because I think when Lost ended, there was, I think it went right to the local news, depending on what time zone you're in. And then it went to like a special. I remember watching the special Jimmy Kimmel episode where he had the whole cast panel interview. So they wanted like a just sort of, instead of just credits, they wanted sort of a soft thing. And yeah, it definitely confused a lot of people. But what's weird to me is that the episode itself explains what's going on very well. So there was, by the time you get to the end credits, I don't know, there really wasn't any reason to be confused, but.
I mean, it just depends how closely you're watching something. That's true. You know what I mean? Some people are just casual watchers. Yeah. But unfortunately,
a lot of people were at watch parties too, I guess.
Yeah. So. Unfortunately, that just like seeped into the groundwater. And so then it just became this like false. When we interviewed Javier Grillo Marks Watch for an earlier episode, and I asked him, like, what's the one thing you would like to tell people about Lost? He was like, that they weren't dead all the time. He was like, I was sitting at a bar once next to some people, and they started talking about how they were dead all the time, and I wanted to, like, yell at them that they weren't, like, strangers, you know?
Oh, to be the people in that bar. You're like, well, you know, Lost, it was dead all the time. And then from across the room, one of the, like, architects of the show is like, wrong!
But, yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's a really unfortunate thing that has dogged the show ever since. But I mean, there are ways, there's a possibility that that is something that they thought they might do, which is like have them be dead all the time. And there's also like aspects of it that, like when Jack is dying in the jungle and you cut between that and the sideways, that's a very what's the short story is Incident at Owl Creek Bridge, right? Where the guy is dying. He takes his whole journey home. In the end, you find out that was really just happening in his head and he was dying the whole time. That's what that final moment is. So like there are, I get how it happened. It's just not what happened.
Right.
And
right.
The phrase they were dead the whole time only applies to the flash sideways in season 6, which also makes it difficult because that part is true.
Yeah.
But then that's not the key to unlock the series. That's Stone Cork.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is that's one of the reasons why I feel like you get a less uniform response from people that watch Lost, because it really does depend on whether you were with it the whole way and more of it makes sense to you versus if you just showed up for the finale at the end. Contrasting that with Thrones, where it felt like every season more and more people were watching Thrones, and by the time we got to the end, there was this huge letdown, and pretty much everybody had the same letdown. You know, I mean, there are still, I'm sure there are plenty of people that like the end of Thrones. I like a lot of that season, but you know, I feel like we all went through this emotional journey together. Whereas when Lost ended, there was a subsection of fans who were like, this is great. You know, it's like what Joanna mentioned earlier about the recappers, where it's like the recappers were like, this was awesome. This was a great finale. Lost really crushed it. And then the next morning you wake up and the entire internet is fractured into two. And, you know, you have half the people shouting about how it didn't answer enough questions and they were dead the whole time. And this was bad. And it's like, I don't know, man, people who watched it intently and stayed with it the entire time seem to have or be more likely to say that, yeah, there were problems in that last season, but I like the finale, you know, kind of where we start as our baseline, you know?
Yeah. It's, our friend, Joe Garfine, had a blog post that she put up that I think she said did massive traffic, is if I can recall correctly, where she saw where the conversation was going. And she was like, she did a list of like who died and when, like when this person mm-hmm. died. And, like, she's like, okay, there's an afterlife and everyone's there and they all look around the same age as we know them now. But the truth is, you know, Kate probably died, you know, several decades from now.
Sure. She had the commune where she and Sawyer and Cassidy and Claire raised all the kids. Hurley could have lived for hundreds of years, as far as we know.
Maybe in the Bardo, you just get to choose, like, how you
What was your best version?
Yeah. And eventually
Richard
Lily's
was
like,
dust by the time they landed. A pile of dust.
Eventually Lily's like, this is my best hair year. Sure. I'm going to go for this year.
And Aaron was like, I want to be a baby again.
Yeah. Things were easier for me before when I was just a baby.
When I was just an island baby, I was fine.
Things are great. I was special. This finale also does like a really great job as far as like expanding beyond plot to make the show like about something retroactively, because the truth is it's an adventure mystery box show, and if we're doing something like Thrones, the truth is you're gonna have the battle for, you know, the forces of good versus supernatural, and then it's about who's gonna get the throne. The end of Thrones has to like answer those two questions at minimum, and Lost has to kind of open its mystery box at minimum, but what it ends up delivering is this fantastic thing that is applicable to like everybody, audience members. It's really easy to empathize with. It recontextualizes a whole bunch of the series, which is like, these relationships are so important. You're going to carry them into the next existential plane. And the fact that you had to all do it together, that thing where like Eloise had to get everybody on the plane, where Locke had to get all the candidates together. It was the together thing that ended up actually mattering more than everything else. And I think it manages to, you know, transcend that a little bit. Whereas sometimes finales spend just all their time answering the plot questions. And like, how did this character die? Sometimes it's just what a finale has to answer. You know, it's, I think this episode does a good job at contextualizing why we showed up for Lost.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and this might just be me, that, you know, one of the big questions the show has the audience asking through the first several seasons is, what is this island? And what's, you know, what's the deal here with this mystery island and all the weird things that happen on it? And I think that the finale gives us enough answers to where it can make sense, but I'm glad, and to the point where I'm glad that they didn't go too far with trying to answer the sort of nature of the island, where, you know, at the end, it just sort of calmly leans into, it really wasn't about the island. It was about the experiences these characters had together and their
the
connection.
Friends we made.
One might
way.
Say that it's the island mystery friends that we've made along the way is what really actually mattered, not necessarily like all the, you know, answers to all the glyphs on the island.
Speaking of the friends we made along the way, I do get emotional every time I see people in the church, except for Saeed and Shannon touching foreheads. But outside of the church, when everyone's like smiling at each other and Matthew Fox like genuinely looks like he's having a good day, is Jorge Garcia. When Hurley sees Charlie for the first time, just like pure sunshine.
Yeah.
And then Miles's face when he sees Sawyer is going to make the flight is also pretty good. Spoiler alert. We'll get back to Miles and Sawyer mm-hmm. in our corners, but that was a nice little, it's my boyfriend moment.
I would like to add to that Jin's face in the hospital when Jin and Son are leaving and Sawyer shows up.
Yeah.
And how happy he is to obviously still exists, having drowned in a terrible submarine, but just how happy he is with how delighted he is in Sawyer not having been woken up yet and just being like, all right, bud, see you there. You know, like, that's great.
Speaking of Sun and Jin. Okay. So like something that I thought was interesting is someone was like, would all of these wake-ups be like joyful moments, or would some of them be more complicated? I think Juliet's feels like the most, like, I think Elizabeth Mitchell plays Juliet's as the most complicated. Like, she's sort of experiencing like a trauma reaction while also the joy is there. So I think that's like Elizabeth Mitchell just crushing the assignment. Sun and Jin is nothing but joy. And there's a nice element of that where you're like, I want to see these two people be happy after they got done so dirty on the island. But there's another part of me that's like, if I'm Sun and Jin and I've made and what happened to me happened to me, wouldn't I wake up feeling a bit more complicated and
about the fact that you abandoned your child?
That I didn't get to see my daughter grow up. You know, I think that might have been an even more I cry every time I see Sun and Jin wake up. But like, wouldn't it have been maybe more emotionally authentic moment for them? I would just argue that Sun and Jin and Saeed still get done dirty in this finale. Because with Saeed, his big moment is not really the Shannon thing. It's like the conversation he has with Hurley that you mentioned, Neil. But what frustrates me is that we're still on this whole like, is Saeed a good man conversation. And I just don't understand why that is what boiled down to be what they thought this character was. Like, isn't that Ben Linus's question? Like, can Ben Linus be a good man? That's an interesting ongoing question that they've had. With Saeed, I'm like, okay, there's the part where he became an assassin again, but didn't Ben tell him he had to be an assassin? Otherwise, all of his friends were going to die. Like, I don't understand like where Saeed relapsed in a way where we were like, other than the fact that when he died and got infected by like muddy water, like, you know, like what why is Saeed's morality still
I mean, it definitely feels like a question that was answered for the audience prior to season six in the temple. Like, Saeed definitely takes like a U-turn because of some bad water, but I mean, I think that's it feels like it might have even been Hurley at one point telling Saeed, you know, in either late season five, early season six, that he was good. But it feels like a question the show had really answered. And as much as I do also love that moment, I love it mostly because of the same kind of thing that I love about the Jin scene, where it's like Hurley knows what's happening. He's fully awake. He's leading his friend down this path, and he's sort of gets to play, you know, he gets to play that God role where he's asking Saeed to go on faith. And I think that's all really good. But yeah, I mean, we knew Saeed was good. If this final episode is still trying to litigate whether Saeed is a good dude, having been a torturer in the army, it answered it many seasons ago. I feel like it answered that question in season one, you know? So
Saeed's a good example of them not landing the plane in terms of like a character arc, because even his waking up is sort of becomes more of a like, hey, we got Shannon back. We weren't able to do it for the season premiere, but we moved heaven and earth to get this actress back. And therefore Saeed, like, there's like, because Boone is also there, and we don't get to see how Boone wakes up. If Boone would have just shown up with an awake Shannon, I would have believed that, you know, siblings, island trauma, cool.
Yeah, and I'm also, as we've been litigating Shannon in the in the church, I think a big question for us is like, yeah, why would it be Shannon? Why wouldn't it be Saeed and Nadia? And why wouldn't it be like Shannon? Because Boone doesn't, it's like everyone's coupled up in the church and then there's Boone. Then Boone's there.
He gets to hug Jack because, you know, everybody else is preoccupied.
Well, and Boone's also one of the characters that does not get a waking up moment.
Exactly.
When we meet him, he's already awake and working with Hurley, which feels like a sort of important gap. I'm not as bothered by Rose and Bernard being there because, you know, maybe I still, from a few episodes ago, think that Bernard may have been slightly awake when he talked to Jack. And maybe they were chilling, avoiding everyone's bullshit in the sideways as well.
Oh, yeah. But if, like, you told me were awake from the plane, I'd be like, probably.
Yeah.
Knowing Rose and Bernard.
But the Boone thing is kind of one of the bigger unanswered questions to me, which is like, we needed Boone back because we wanted the original sort of main cast in the church, but we couldn't have at least had like one moment somewhere where
We don't even have enough moments to connect the dots. Like, I assume Penny's there because Desmond went to coffee with her, and like at the coffee, he like gave her a little Christmas tree, and she's like, "Oh my God, I remember!" You know, like,
right.
I could
Christmas woke Penny up.
I could imagine that happening off screen, and that makes sense because we saw that they're gonna get together, and then we saw her at the church. But Boone like left pretty asleep last time we saw him, and now he's just back. Taking some punch.
I know what happened.
Oh,
Hurley gooped him.
Sorry, dude. Goop.
He got gooped awake. You know.
Yeah, I mean it's weird. And as much as I like, especially the stuff where Libby and Hurley sort of wake each other up, but Libby got a wake up scene and Boone did not, which seems imbalanced in a way based on how important their characters seemed throughout the show. You know. But then again,
Summerholder is like, he's sparkling. You know what I mean?
I mean, I guess Boone may hold a heavier significance to us because we've had a corner named after him since he fell down the first time. Whereas like the show kind of forgot about him for several seasons.
I have a question about the big dramatic plane, the Ajira flight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's big. It's funny. Miles is doing the duct tape thing. Frank has a purpose. Rich is going to get to leave the island after centuries. Sawyer's going to
leave. He's getting gray hair. He's aging. Which
he's aging.
I had forgotten in a storm previous. He ages when the Jacob ashes are gone. Finally, when he starts aging.
Is it with the Jacob ashes or when Jack becomes?
Yeah, I think it's
either way.
Jacob's gone, all of Jacob's rules are off, and now it's Jack's rules.
But he was saved by immortality when he got smoke punched.
Sure.
So it's possible that, as you said, Richard is just a pile of ashes by the time they get back to the mainland. That's possible. But like, it's this big moment. We get Claire on the flight. It's all good. But is it undermined at all by the fact that like they were, if they had just stayed where they were, they would have been fine? Because Hyder doesn't go into the ocean.
That's true.
And Ben and Hurley are fine.
They could have taken Desmond with them at that point.
Yeah. Well, the runway does crumble beneath them, so they can't use the runway. But
I would say the new man in charge, in which we see Hurley and Ben off the island, implies that our other pals could have gotten off the island too, right?
Or could have come back and visited at some point.
Yeah, well,
but I'm
saying
like
that's how we sort of like leave Hurley. Hurley's like, "How am I to get Desmond off the island? He can't leave." And Ben's like, "There are no rules. There are only your rules." So if Hurley wants to visit him,
yeah,
that's cool. Yeah,
no, but my point is, if the Ajira flight hadn't taken off, they would have been fine. That's my point.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
But
it's
also
an emotional moment. It's beautiful. I love it. But like, they would have been fine.
Yeah. Well, and you know, this is one of the things that I think like or dislike this about it, but it is something that serves Jack's character more than it necessarily serves. I mean, I do like the moment where like Kate has to convince Claire and then they're holding hands and it's sort of like, we're going off onto this adventure to reunite you with your son together. But I think it's really there for that moment at the very end, which is, you know, one of my favorite shots of the finale. It's from Jack's point of view, watching the plane. So it's like Jack, as he's dying, seeing sort of the fruits of his sacrifice as his friends escape. I mean, for all Jack knows, they could have crashed, like 5 minutes later in the ocean, but you know, at least he gets to go out with, you know, a dog at his side and the peaceful thought that he saved not only the island, but the people that he loves, you know?
Right. 5 minutes later, the duct tape starts to fall apart. <Right. laughs> Everything goes.
I mean, we didn't get enough Miles in season six, I think it's fair to say. But there's some good Miles and Frank stuff in this episode, and it's great to have Frank back. And I love the whole duct tape thing. It's great. I mean, it's just it adds urgency because I think there is sort of a still, not necessarily a stillness, but a slower pace to what Jack's doing. It's more methodical. They got to climb down into the cave and all this stuff. But then there's this sort of frantic set of scenes where Frank and Miles and Richard are trying to get the plane back up and running. And I like that for those characters. It works really well.
Oh, yeah. It gives a lot of momentum. It's really good for plot. And I don't think I'm being nit. I don't think it's nitpicky, but it's just sort of like it just occurred to me this time when I was watching it where I was like, oh, but also they would have been fine.
Yeah.
But this is exciting also and emotional. You know what I mean? So.
Well, and Sawyer and Kate deserve to get off on that runway. They built that runway.
It's true.
They sure did.
Let it come full circle. Jacob was like, build the runway. You'll see. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he told Ben's crew.
He told Richard, who told Ben.
Right. He told his third-party consultant, Richard, to tell Ben back
nine
when.
Nine steps up the org chart.
Oh, yeah. I guess there are also other people on the island, but we don't worry about them.
Yeah, Cindy and the kids are probably still alive, right?
Yeah, hopefully, as long as they weren't standing near any loose rock when shit started going down.
I think it would have been fun to put Cindy and the kids in the church.
They are definitely in their own church. Yeah. Cindy and the kids are like, just the three of us. I can't believe they made it that far. Good mm-hmm. for them. Good for them. Fun fact that I learned from Wikipedia, from Lostpedia, Visions of Joanna, spelled with an H, by Bob Dylan, was supposed to be sort of the opening song over the deplaning of the coffin. And I think it would have been a nice little memorial to our drowned castaway, Joanna, from season one.
So. Oh, Joanna, were you important? We'll never know.
Because they couldn't get the rights to the Bob Dylan song.
That version, that church is all of the red shirt, all the meat puppets or meat all socks that were killed.
Oh, Scott Steve is there. Steve.
Could you actually believe what our podcast theories would be like if that had gone on? Like, considering they just put some bonus footage over the credits and caused this whole kerfuffle. Mm-hmm. If they did a Joanna callback in the beginning of the series finale,
well, and in
be
that,
like, why was Joanna important?
In that Bardo, it's Ethan that's going around and waking people up with his sinister Mapother energy.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Who the hell's Ethan's whose Bardo is he part of? Is he Stardust?
Amy and Horace's.
Oh, I mean, that's got to be Ben's Bardo if it's anybody's Bardo, right? He just has to get around to Ethan.
Sure.
Shitty Dharma Initiative Bardo.
Yeah. He's got his dad there. He's got Alex. He's got Danielle. He's
maybe
got
that's where what's her name went. Was it Annie? Who was
Annie's
his friend?
There.
Annie's there.
Miss Clue is there. Bea Clue is there.
Harper might be there.
Oh,
no one's
Harper.
Happy about it, but Harper's there.
Yeah, Harper. Yeah, get out of my bar now, Harper.
Speaking of the coffin deplaning, I just want to note for our listeners that all of the stickers that are on the crate that is carrying Christian Shepherd's coffin, one indicates that it did indeed go to Guam. So,
yep.
Good
somebody
job, coffin.
Actually made it to Guam.
And it was Christian Shepherd.
Christian Shepherd, kind of on the nose, don't you think? there was a question here, I think. Yeah, here we go. Did this show need a literal Jacob? Let's probe where that came from. I'm assuming this is a Joanna note.
Joanna,
what made you conjure this thought?
It's something I asked Damon Lindelof between the last two seasons. And I was like, did you ever think about not literalizing your island god and just making Jacob a figure we never saw, which would be, I mean, he's had gods in both of his other shows, to be honest with you. But I was like, you know, as Damon leans more and more into this idea of not showing us all the things, would it have been better to not have a physical Jacob and not, and therefore skip some of the things like bottle ceremonies and stuff like that, and just make it a little bit more esoteric? And Damon says, no, it didn't really occur to him, but I think the show would have been better without a literal Jacob. That's what I think.
I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay.
Because this is a bad dad show. And if you don't reveal God to be a bad dad, what are you doing? It'd be like doing Preacher, but not having God show up at some point. I think it's sort of in the premise if you're going to go that big. If there is an island God and he's not necessarily benevolent because he's fallible, that's interesting to me. But it also necessitates seeing him so you don't have to do this gigantic thing where you're just ragging on like monotheistic religions by being like, you can't prove that he's there. And if he's there, he's bad. Like, fuck your real life. I think Jacob allows him to go around that.
But I think Jacob as a villain is kind of more of a 2021 reading than it was at the time. Because, like, yeah, we've got him being kind of a shitty little mama's boy in Across the Sea. But I still think we were not critically in a place where we were ready to be like, so God sucks, right? Like, I think of a network television show.
Right. But I do think it's there. And I think it's easier to analyze it than it would have been yelling into a void that we had to project things and opinions on based on inconsistent actions on a week-to-week, season-to-season television show.
I guess I would say if you literalize something like Jacob or like this church, because you can call, I mean, I think for many years I used to call it the like non-denominational meeting place in the sky because, of course, there's that stained glass window that tries to have it always with like a Star of David.
All the symbols.
And some other stuff, right? But like it's a church. And so I think to make it a church makes it slightly alienating to people who don't think of the afterlife in that way. Do you know?
Sure. Could have been a rec center or something. I don't know.
But I do think that like also
could have
the
been,
fact
could
that
could have been
Jake...
the stadium.
Sure.
I think baggage claim.
They sidestep that being part of the Jacob problem by not having any of the God characters in the Bardo, thank God. If they would have done like one of those to like sneakily wink a little cameo, it would have torn apart the mythology. It's like, why are the gods here?
Sure.
But I do think it this show benefits having Jacob. I was going back and listening to some of your previous Damon Lindelof episodes, and there's one in season two where you're talking about Michael Emerson joining the show and being like, since you discovered, you know, Ben, when you realized Michael Emerson was so good, like, who did you think the leader of the others was? And he's like, well, we sort of had Jacob in mind. We beep it because it's a podcast about spoilers and that. But they were already building to like Jacob somewhat having power over the others. And so that feels like they were building to not a benevolent God from the start. Like if he's leading the like scary others in season two, which is what we knew about the others at that point, I still think Jacob begins as a God you're supposed to question. And it's so much easier to literally have somebody there and show them to be fallible than it is to try to be like to prove somebody's faith fallible is weird in terms of television storytelling.
Well, I just don't think that like... I think you make some great points. I just don't think that when people were talking about Lost at the time, they were spending a lot of time talking about, is the point of the show that God's an asshole? Because I think you're really helped to that conclusion by watching some of Damon Lindelof's other stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like once you grok onto sort of his take on religion, then it makes a lot more sense, too. And again, I don't mean to leave Carlton out of this at all. Obviously, Carlton's a creative force behind all of this. Obviously, this is a twofer. Again, if Carlton Cuse wants to come on this podcast and talk to me about anything, I'm
now is the absolute last possible moment.
Carlton Cuse could decide he wants to be on the podcast.
I have one thought about this, and it's not really related to like examining this as a bad God. I think that it probably overcomplicates what you need to do to make the Man in Black into the villain in season six. Like, cause if you don't literalize Jacob, do you still have a literalized Man in Black? Like is it just the smoke monster in the end that is doing bad stuff?
What if Job fought back?
Right. I mean,
Man in Black.
And I know we've talked about ways in which they could have made sort of admitted that he was the villain a little earlier and maybe made him a little more menacing. I think he gets really menacing here at the end, which is good and a testament to Terry O'Quinn's magnificent performance on all fronts. But I do think if you remove a literal Jacob, it makes it harder to pull off some of the emotional stuff around why the Man in Black is so hellbent on leaving the island, you know?
Yeah. I guess I could also see a way around Jacob if you have more trustworthy prophet characters. Like if Echo had stuck around, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like Echo and Richard could have actually been like a mouthpiece for like this island god, then at least we're getting perspectives from Jacob that we could claim are authoritarian or authority, actual things from Jacob. But otherwise, by the way they treat him and then him like not talking to Ben and him probably not being in the cabin, I think he does kind of have to show up at that point. But it is interesting thought about how this would have been differently constructed if the island god was never yeah. seen.
Well, and also does Jack not become the island god? Jack and Hurley not become the island god at the end? Because you sort of, I don't know, it feels like you sort of need Jacob there to be like, now you're like me. Right, in order for us to believe that Jack has transcended from just being plain old Jack to in charge of the heart of the island. I think it's possible. I think you just probably have to change a lot of what season six is in order to not have Jacob show up in
which
a little bad,
is fine. We're not
way.
Saying we do Lost better, but we would change a lot about season six.
I mean, on that particular subject, not to go all the way back to that email, but it's not to say that we could do Lost better. It's to say that knowing the whole of Lost, a lot of people could probably go back and make a couple tweaks that would feel better. But it wouldn't be Lost if we just went back and made a couple of changes. Like I think there's a significance to the fact that it played out the way it did. And, you know, for better or worse, it sort of all worked out like it was supposed to, I guess.
Yeah, swapping out the magical mystery of why is there a polar bear on this tropical island with some sort of answer, I think inevitably leads to Cave of Light or giant volcano fist fight. Like that's dramatically where you want your climax to be. It's not necessarily climactic answers, because how many climactic answers can you really have that emotionally pay off? Which is sort of what the new man in charge is about, is wrapping up some of those other things that they just got to the end of the series and knew people were going to be nitpicky about other questions. So they shunted some more things in there. Is it time to briefly hit on the new man in charge?
Sure.
Neil, what do you remember about the new man in charge?
Absolutely nothing.
All right. The new man in charge.
It's about Hurley. I know that much.
It's about Hurley and Ben, and Dharma drops. Joanna, give us a rundown if you can recall. New man in charge.
There's two. This is how you know, actually, that Rose and Bernard do not live out the rest of their life on this island, unless Hurley made Ben immortal. Because Ben, so one aspect of new man in charge is Ben goes to the place where there are two Dharma Initiative employees whose only job is to organize the Dharma drop, the goods, the grocery drop.
The palettes from season two.
Yeah, and it answers the question, why, if the Dharma Initiative was purged, are there still drops of supplies on the island? This answers the question, like, basically nobody thought to fire these guys. And so Hurley, being the conscientious number one that he is, sends his number two to be like, hey, you guys can go now. You're done.
Here's
now.
An envelope full of money. Off you go.
But I mean, like, Rose and Bernard in the finale, their pantry is still stocked with, they are intercepting those pallets. Mm-hmm. They're stocked with Dharma supplies. So, and then they have questions. And Ben's like, I'm going to show you some videos. I'm going to show you a video. And then I'm going to answer like two questions or something like that. And he gets out a CD envelope, is my memory. You remember those?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And pulls out like
CDs.
Yeah, pulls out a DVD version of one of the like Dr. Pierre Chang an orientation videos, and he shows it to them.
And it's the Hydra orientation video specifically, because we have a lot of questions about Hydra.
Right. So he's talking about the Hurley bird. The Hurley bird gets answered. The polar bears get answered. And that's it. And then I think they have like one more question for Ben, and he answers it. And then he's like, that's it. All right, we're done here. Bye. That's my memory of that section. Right.
Yes.
And then the other section is, I think, are they in a blue VW van?
That's at the very end. It starts in back at, what our mental institution hospital.
Oh, Santa Rosa.
Santa Rosa.
Okay. Starts Santa Rosa and Walt's a patient. And Hurley's like, hey, dude. Surprise, shorty.
Ben shows up again. He's like, you're still special. Oh, okay, I have someone to meet you.
Thank
out
you.
There.
Okay.
And then Ben takes him outside to a blue VW van, and in the back seat is Hurley in a dark shirt as the island god, who says he wants to talk to Walt about a job and series.
So it ties up a nice, like, wait, wasn't Walt supposed to be special? Mm-hmm. Hurley's like, yeah, you're special, and also you can be the boss if you want to, but also you want to come to talk to your ghost dad. I suppose I expect that that's part of the whole thing, right? Come talk to your ghost dad.
Yeah, say he could come help Michael back on the island.
Yeah, so that helps us feel better about the fact that Michael is not in the church. I mean, like, of all the only person who was on the original flight not in the church are Michael and Walt, because Nikki and Paula aren't there either, but those are later people, right? Yeah. And Echo isn't there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like Walt and Michael, forever maligned by the show, are not in the church. So listen, you could be as tall as you want to be in the sideways is my point. So so it gives a nice little button for Walt, who is still special. Yeah, and so this idea that Hurley doesn't have to do this job his whole life or for all eternity if he doesn't want to, if he wants to, you know, train Walt up, and then when Walt decides he wants to do it, like, he can do it. I think that's how Hurley would run things. So, you know.
Yeah, use all Walt's electro powers to network the light and figure out a way to get the benefits of the light out to the people using electro Walt.
That's definitely what he would do.
Make him like an electromagnetic Dr. Manhattan. All of my Lindelof series is at once. That's the last finale.
Well, and Walt discovers that he can transport himself back through time, like a vision of him, but he always comes out wet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all about Walt trying to solve for that, because he keeps going back to try and warn Shannon, and it's not working.
There's an episode called The Past is Wet, and it's like, what the fuck is that about?
Oh, yikes.
It'll be sweet. God. All right, Joanna, you have a list of other series that have had finales. They have done their run successfully and have capped off with finales.
That's not my point.
Oh.
My point was, you still see the fingerprints of Lost to this day. And maybe we'll talk about this in one of our bonus episodes that we do, but like the legacy of Lost, like at the time there were these like really dumb knockoff versions of Lost. Mm-hmm. But what's true is that beyond those, this like, and beyond Damon Lindelof's other shows, the legacy of Lost is churning in some of your favorite shows. Like White Lotus, a bunch of strangers brought to an island, interact with each other. You get to know their backstory as they're there. I mean, it's Survivor, and Mike White's a big Survivor fan, so it's Survivor, but it's also Lost. The Good Place is emphatically Lost. Michael Schur consulted with Damon Lindelof to be like, hey, I want to do this thing. Will you help me? And Damon Lindelof helped him make The Good Place. And there's a number, if you go rewatch The Good Place, having seen Lost, there are a number of direct Lost allusions in that. Westworld had season 2 episode that is essentially Desmond in the hatch, nearly shot for shot. And then the Loki finale is essentially Lost. So it's just like you can see it. Everything has the Lost impact, because the people who are making television now are the people who were 11 years old or older when Lost was on. And it was just such a tremendously influential series for people who love story. So that construction, you can see it even like stupid, like I was watching a really shitty Netflix ice skating show. I couldn't tell you why I was watching, and I couldn't tell you what it was called. But every episode started with like had flashbacks to a different character. That's Lost. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's Lost. So it's in the groundwater of our TV storytelling in a major way.
Yeah. There's also multiple great jokes about Lost in Bob's Burgers, among other things. Like an episode where they go to a performing arts school and like three of the kids are named Sawyer, and they get to the final Sawyer, and Tina Belcher is like, why are there so many Sawyers? And he's like, Lost was big when we were born.
That is true. Java watched that episode like a couple days ago, and I had forgotten that joke existed.
It's so great.
It's like all the Daenerys.
Right. It's like all the Daenerys.
Aww.
Except, yeah, I mean, you don't want to be named after... Well, you do want to be named after James Ford. I don't think you want to be named after Sawyer. That's, you know, that's a complicated name in mythology to take on.
On Island, Sawyer was pretty great for a while there. Naming anybody after Anthony Cooper.
Yeah, do we think Off Island, or do we think Sideways Anthony Cooper really exists?
Fuck that guy.
Yeah, he might
There's
have been
Stardust. Star stuff in the world.
Yeah, we're rooting for Helen to exist, but not so much for Anthony Cooper.
Well, he is tied to multiple people's backstories that don't matter in the Sideways because they have to transcend them. But in theory, Sawyer was still looking for an Anthony Cooper. So, you know, all of that, like David, maybe he's stardusted because, yeah, it feels weird. I think, yeah. I'm going to say Stardust because it makes me feel better, and I don't want to think about Anthony Cooper's Bardo. Although maybe it makes me feel better that he's like more conscious, but like trapped in a body. I don't know. I don't want to wish ill on people's afterlife. So that seems a little much. if you made it to the Bardo, I hope you're okay.
Yeah. Anthony Cooper's Bardo is he has to go apologize to Sawyer's parents in the afterlife.
Yes. It's the 70s forever in Anthony Cooper's Bardo. I mean, I'm actually, that sounds interesting now. I'm come full circle. In the initial script for the end, Ben actually got to wake up. Joanna, it appears that you've taken a peek at this scene.
Well, I mean, I think we know that he's woken up. He's just decided not to move on, right?
Yes.
But in a deleted scene, he wakes up by looking at Alex's picture in a yearbook, and that's what wakes him up. And that's pretty inert. I'm kind of glad they cut that because, like, he spent so much time with her already. Or why didn't they just put it in the penultimate episode? Do you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, why didn't it happen, like, the night he hung out with?
Yeah, Coco Van Night.
Yeah. From what I also understand, his flashes would have involved Alex, but also his horrible deeds. So because it appeared so early in this episode, they're still trying to play that. You know, is Ben a good person / he's going to, you know, not go into the church this time around, which might have just been like a layer too complex for this episode that just wants to hit you with the feels all the way through and doesn't necessarily want to lead into the purgatory idea yet.
And hit me it does.
And hit you with the feels it does. Because it has set all the pieces. All right. Let's hit the vending machine metaphor, which, as Neil has pointed out, maybe on the show, maybe right before we started recording, much like the vending machine in the Sideways, the island just needs to be unplugged and then replugged in, and then like things kind of work out.
Have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again?
Yeah. And they couch that lamp shading right next to the most dramatic waking up, so I had forgotten completely that it existed. But good on you, Juliet. Juliet knew the answer.
Yeah. They finally found the right way to reset things, and it did not involve a bomb, which is good.
Did it involve the bomb? Joanna seems to have a note here that asks if this was caused by the bomb.
That's a question people still have to this day. Did the bomb create the Bardo? Because Christian just says, like, you all created this place together. Did the bomb create the Bardo because we flash from white to whatever? I think no, but I'm not against that as an interpretation that some people have. You know,
if the bomb created the Bardo, who put Dojin in it?
Because
we hadn't met him then.
Or how did Boone get in there? It? Because he was gone by then.
But Boone was part of the memories of the people who Avengers Endgame time traveling rules meant that their past could never be changed because even though it was our future, it was their past.
Well, maybe it was the initial incident that started the Bardo when Desmond forgot to push the button and caused the plane crash. You know, because that's what they returned to in the Sideways is them being on the plane. So you almost feel like that if there is a reset moment where the Bardo is created somewhere in the show, it's literally in the first scene. You know?
Yeah. I think the series has a perfect time loop built into it, which is they cause the explosion of the incident, which causes the hatch to be created, which causes Desmond to be in the hatch, which causes Desmond to down the plane, which also causes him to be close to this electromagnetic event, which maybe he's become used to by spending so much time and like near this magnetic wall. So then he becomes the only person in the island's history, apparently, that is capable of withstanding the full heart of the island thing. So it's like that loop, I think, needs to happen for the show to happen. And I think they managed to pull it off really cleanly, separately entirely from the Jacob and Man in Black storyline. Because after we're sort of done establishing that loop, that's when we get into the what's it all for, what are the candidates, that sort of thing. But even on a rewatch, that loop works really nice for me. And that logic that lets our time daddy be right really works for me.
Time daddy!
I mean, I'm sad that he has to wear the hat, but I'm glad that Faraday gets to show up here.
Glad that he finally gets to play piano next to Drive Shaft.
Oh my god.
All right. I'm going to hand it over here. What are some points we need to hit before we take off to our corners? We've got lots of notes here, but I think we
I really want to say is there, like, in addition to this being a clip show, it has that nice meta, are you ready to move on aspect of a finale, which I really like. My two favorite other versions of this are in Doctor Who and David Tennant's last episode when he says, like, I don't want to go, and he's like crying, and you know that, like, the actor is like processing leaving the part, you know what I mean? Or when you have in 6 Feet Under Nate say, you can't take a picture of this, it's already gone, to Claire in the finale of 6 Feet Under, like that kind of goodbye aspect, and The Good Place had this in spades. So you get to watch characters say goodbye or move on or talk about being ready to move on, while the creators are processing ending this big, you know, when you think about like, this time you spent on the island was the most important thing you did. The people who wrote this are Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, who are saying, this time we spent making this show, which at one point was like the biggest thing in the whole world, is up until now in our lives at least, the biggest thing we ever did. This time we spent together. This mattered. This journey mattered. It meant something. And I just think that that's a beautiful sort of metatextual thing that's woven into the finale here.
Yeah. Well, and also is part of that thing that I was talking about before. That's what being able to take it to that level is what lets any audience member empathize, because they can make it about the show. They get to make it about their connection to the show. In this case, we did a whole rewatch while a pandemic was on. So it works like again. Mm-hmm. It's just being able to make that universal and true.
Yeah.
Well, in this context is a
and if way. You binge watch or rewatch Lost at any point, it's 121 hours of television. So it's always going to be a big project, right? Like, even if you binge it all the way through over the course of a couple of weeks. So by the time you get to the end of it, it's like, I am ready to move on.
We did it.
Yeah, it's like a lot of it's satisfying, but 121 hours is a lot of television.
It is. And, you know, they got thrown into it, like Joanna said, and it got accelerated and became super popular, but they had to steer this thing, and then they were like, please let us end it, and ABC was like, cool, and they did it. It's a quite the television accomplishment. And I think holds up very well over 10 years later. How long do I have to wait before I look back at the Game of Thrones finale and think that it's good? Not yet, I can tell you that. So two years down, and hasn't happened yet. Maybe you got to give it another 8 years. But we will find out some very notable things about this episode for our final corners right after this.
Okay, now Dave's trying to make me cry with a music cue. Now is the time of the podcast where we're going to thank all the people in the Bardo with us who have come along. Actually, everyone listening is in the Bardo with us. But here are some folks that are, I don't know, towards the front of the church. These are our small council subscribers. They're hanging out at the $10 level or above on our Patreon. It let's start with some new folks in the non-denominational Church of the Sky. Jerry Weston, Jesse Baird, Allison Heishman, Eric Carey, Tess, Sue Jake, I'm really gonna cry. Sue Jacob, Jana Gardner, Max Stauffer, Grace Richardson, Jolie Latini, Lizzie Hale, Raymond, Caleb Masters, Kelly Gallagher, Sarah Edelhart, Jamie Smith, David G.
David G.
David G.
Melissa Beerley, Jan Carlos, Lord of the Soups and Warren of the Grill, and Stephen Miller. Thank you so much.
Do these people paid good money to hear you cry, Joanna?
I'm crying.
And I would like to add to that thanks William Eggert, Susan Shirley, Weed Detective, Molly Callahan, Gabriel Butzko, Pat Jukins, Angelica Cotto, Catherine Davis, the Ghost of Ghost. Hey, I know what that means. Jeffrey Sirwa, Caroline, Cindy Schultz, Caleb O'Brien, Justin Moy, Kathleen Laurand, Alan Harlan, Percival Buenaventura, Tony Perez, Jason Allen, and Jack Sinclair. Thank you guys very much.
And with such a wonderful assist from some very melancholy Giacchino, I would like to thank the following fine humans: Jen Davis, Ole Ballman, Ramses Severiano, there we go, Catherine Altmaier, Bryce Pulls, Dana Quinley, Lauren Hunter, Laura Fairbanks, Danielle Wilkinson, Anya Suzanne Sandness, Diana Fisher, Sam Williams, Delia Voch, Beth Weingarner, Mike Harris, Matthew Wilson, Grayson Owen, Guava Corvallis, Emily Ann, Lauren Adams, and Jacob. Thank you all for being members of the small council or candidates or, you know, whatever your bardo says you
former
are.
Former island gods, apparently.
Yeah.
Oh, there really was a Jacob at the bottom.
Yeah. Not- yeah. That worked out really, Jacob. Really well.
It worked out very much. Popped up right at the end, just like it lost. So
that's funny.
And we're back. We're going to do the corners. This is where we usually do the storm, but as we mentioned, no more storm. Lost happened.
I have a couple emails that I want to read. I'm so sorry that I didn't read them before.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, definitely. This is a great time.
Okay. So these are the two emails I mentioned before from like listeners, one of whom really liked the finale, one of whom had some criticisms of the final season. So let's start with Jeff, who titled his email, "Everyone Dies Sometimes, Kiddo, and I Cried." So anyway, Jeff wrote, "I'm a sucker
for..." Oh, do you want the music again?
Nope, thank you. Jeff wrote, "I'm a sucker for father and son stories in film and TV, so the final scene of The End really gets to me. I don't care about why Libby was in Santa Rosa, where Annie went, or who was in the outrigger, because I got a scene as sweet and sad and touching as Christian Shepherd easing his son into the realization he died. I remember the night the Lost finale aired, comedian Brian McElhenney of Britannic tweeted something along the lines of how he hopes that's what death is really like. I agree. I'm not a religious person, but if there's an afterlife, I also hope my dad, who died a month after the finale, is there to greet me along with everyone I ever loved and soften the blow. Then how are you here right now? How are you here? Exchange makes me cry every time for this reason. I get so angry when people whine and moan about answers when they were gifted with something as nice as that ending. But instead of letting go and moving on, we still have people demanding to know about the polar bears, even though the show answered that like five times. The DVD epilogue even wastes time answering that again, and people still ask the question. There's even professional critics who I respect and consider smart who dismiss the finale as they were dead the whole time, even though Christian says out loud that's not what happened. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot lately about things not lasting forever, Ozymandias and all that, and how at death's door, all this BS we deal with in life will seem so petty in hindsight. Like how you don't even remember what you and someone close to you were fighting about. That's one of the many things I think The End is getting at. Why should the real Locke care anymore? He was most often odds with Jack. They're dead now. That's why he greets him in the church with the show's final line, "We've been waiting for you." Jeff, P.S. As always, I love the podcast. I loved going on this rewatch journey with you all. And sorry to be a broken record, but BSG would be a great next show to cover. P.P.S. If we're all going with the theory that David isn't real and is a manifestation of Jack's inner child, then it's safe to assume baby Aaron in the Flash sideways isn't real either. He just can't be real because who wants to spend most of the time in a purgatory in a womb? Aaron probably moved on with other people who mattered to him more from later in life. Lost to Dave. So that's from Jeff.
Yes, but I can't do Lost better than Lost was done, but absolutely give me Lost 2.
It's about Aaron and Ji-Yun and their church.
Yeah. Also, I wouldn't mind spending some of the Bardo in the womb. In terms of, like, Bardo, like, Ben keeps getting punched in the face. Like, womb sounds great. You know, with you're all, like warm.
Like I said, maybe Aaron was like, I was better off as a baby. I'm not going to lie. Maybe he just sucked the rest of his life.
You know what happened to Aaron? Real 2020 happened to Aaron. He was like, fuck, I used to be a baby on an island of mystery.
And then this email comes from a different Eric than the other Eric email that I read. And Eric writes, I've always felt that the ending of Lost can be really bifurcated into two parts, the finale episode itself and then the ending in general. For the ending in general, I almost feel that refers just to season six as a whole. And I think that too often when discussions over the ending of Lost comes up, you end up with ships missing in the night as one side is referring to the finale episode and the other to season six. So with regards to the finale, I've always felt it makes so much more sense as an exercise if I remind myself that it is a network TV finale. The Lost finale works very well as an emotional goodbye to the friends we spent 6 years with. Everyone gets together, we get highlight clips, emotional speeches, Giacchino-ing, and then we all move on. That's what TV finales kind of used to be, and many still are. Parks and Rec, The Good Place, finales share tons of DNA with this episode, and those ending works tremendously well. With Lost, it feels like it should be the same way. The on-island story concludes, and we get an emotional goodbye to our friends we've had for 6 years. The finale is good as an episode, but even as someone who loved the show from start to finish, I have to admit that overall the ending doesn't totally work. So why didn't it work? This is where I think the general ending and the entire season comes into play. Fundamentally, any TV finale has another more subtle task than just finishing the plot and giving the characters an emotional goodbye. It also has to make it feel like watching the show was worth your time. This is going to be a different beast for every show because expectations come into play. For a sitcom, it could be an easier task. For a procedural drama, the same. For a serialized, mysterious show, it's one of the harder tasks around. How do you make someone leave Lost feeling like the investment was worth the time and it mattered? Because fundamentally, it's a TV show and will never be more than that. Also, side note, are how many shows with this level of serialization that ran for more than 121 episodes? I couldn't think of any, but I probably am just dumb. Shows like How I Met Your Mother or Dexter, allegedly, I've never seen it, so royally messed up this concept that it made people retroactively hate the show. Thrones ran into a similar problem where they really needed to fulfill an 8 to 23 years of emotional investment from fans. And even if they had been engaged and remembered the Iron Fleet, it would have been a gargantuan task. While the Lost finale episode really tried to accomplish this, I think it was hamstrung by the structure of season 6. Fundamentally, the final season was structured in a way that made it really easy to feel like the first 5 seasons of the show didn't matter. The Flash Sideways afterlife is a wonderful concept, and getting to see our characters with the one thing they most wish changed in place is pretty neat and fun. However, it creates a few problems for the general ending. And I referenced some of this stuff before, but let me just buzz through it. Reverts characters back to season 1 state for a large portion of the season. It's an afterlife, and afterlife structurally lend themselves to making it feel like everything that came before didn't matter. The fact that so many characters are anchored to early season moments, Hurley and Libby as an example, also lends itself to cheapening everything that comes after. It was too fun for the writers and took away energy and attention to the main island story. This is something I think you all highlighted well in the rewatch, is how much the writers are kind of just spinning their wheels in the main island story, but have lots of creative fun in The Flash Sideways. And had The Flash Sideways done some sort of sci-fi connection with the main world, maybe that would have been okay. But it's revealed to be an epilogue and ends up making all that previous wheel spinning feel kind of cheap. And then Eric goes on for many, many paragraphs, great paragraphs, to suggest ways to fix it. One being the idea of making The Flash Sideways feel a little bit more surreal so that it didn't feel cool. Like, maybe would have been like, oh yeah, this is what I thought was happening, rather than like a big, whoa, this was the afterlife sort of thing. And then Eric says, I'll end it here. This is too long, but I really love this pod and look forward to whatever you tackle next, especially if it's the leftovers of Heart Will Catch Fire. Thank you all so much for your great work, and never, ever, 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 ever tighten up. I mean, as we look down the barrel of like an over 2-hour podcast, I think we fulfilled that prompt, Eric, but thank you so much for that email. But yeah, I mean, I just thought Eric, I mean, there's stuff I left out, so I apologize, Eric, if I blundered your point at all, but I think Eric makes some reasonable arguments as to why the final season of the show can feel janky, even if you do like the finale. And I think we've talked about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. there's other shows that I think ran into this problem and dealt with it in different ways. But I think like Lost specifically, for me, I can kind of write off season six as its own little story because the time season works so well for me in creating the incident loop, in giving background to the Dharma Initiative, in giving background to the others. Like, I don't need a ton of background of the others beyond season three and season five. That seems like fine to me. Like, ooh, attractive Charles Widmore. Like, that they could have just left it at that. It would have been fine. but then season six is about, you know, justifying the sideways and then about the mythic god level of the storyline. And I don't think Lost needed it because it was kind of like a different show. But I do think the series overall benefits with that character depth. Sort of like how Fringe wrapped up its mystery story. So its final season is like an abbreviated season that just takes place in an alternate future. And they just juice the entire same thing that Lost is juicing, which is like, let's see characters we like, but in situations that are kind of unfamiliar, but also kind of familiar. How would they react in like different situations? So I could see how like that, whether or not it works for you, how occasionally, if you want, there are certain runs of television shows, especially ones that had to do 22 episode seasons and didn't know what season was going to be their last, that do sort of sidestep into doing the thing that I said this episode wasn't, but like a denouement sort of style season. Like, I wouldn't have been happy if Lost ended in the first episode of season six, but I would have appreciated the Juliet loop and it's anticipated that like paying off, not necessarily the temple and the god stuff, but you know, it works. Does it work as well as the time loop season does in explaining the rest of the season or the rest of the seasons? I don't think so, but it's, you know, not a novel. That's a weird way to write it off, but that's a side, a side effect of not having your complete story meted out in a way that you can plan is sometimes you just have to do a hard pivot into a different type of story. Yeah. I'll take it. American Horror Story can't even make it through one season without pivoting, so Lost made it through five and then pivoted. Great.
Do you get mad if I correct you on a word that you said a couple times now?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I won't get mad. Please do correct me.
It's denouement.
Denouement.
Mon.
Denouement.
Denouement.
Sorry. Yes. I don't know how to... I can't write that one off because am I even pronouncing it how it's spelled? Probably not. Who knows?
That's fair.
I mean, it's French. It's complicated.
The part after the climax that comes before the end of the story.
It's a word. It's a word I know very well, only because my sister uses it all the time. In place of just like, she could just say the ending, and anytime that she could say the ending, she's like in the denouement, and I'm like, Morgan, you don't always have to say denouement. You can sometimes just say the end. Anyway.
It was part of my very early screenwriting classes at NYU, which I only mentioned to shout out Britannic, the NYU-based group of comedians that were in that email.
True.
Always good to think about Britannic. More YouTube stuff for you guys to look up after you watch The New Man in Charge. All right, I think it's time to get to some corners. Neil, we start as we always do with Giacchino Corner.
Hell yeah. Well, Giacchino out here making us cry watching the episode, making us cry while we're reading names. there's a lot of it going around. One fascinating, there is a long list of tracks that exist on this, but we've talked about most of them. There's only a couple new ones. The one that is most interesting name-wise is that they, you know, Joanna mentioned that the Bob Dylan song, what was the song again?
Visions
of Joanna was supposed to open. Instead, they open with an orchestral track that's based on the LAX theme, which was introduced in the first episode of the season. But it's called Parallelocam. I guess because it's
sweaty. It's
showing both the universes next to
showing
each other, I guess.
Both the universes, yeah. So that's a fun one. We also get, and I think these are two really good pieces of score for a couple of reasons. There's one called The Whole Shebang, which is what plays sort of over the montage of the plane taking off and Jack's, you know, the first part of Jack dying. Jack dies for so long. And what's great about this one is that it mixes in like six or seven different themes and motifs. And I think what you're hearing is Giacchino sort of try to bring a lot of as much of the previous six seasons of score together. Like, we even get a little bit of the traveling theme, which I love. That big pan shot where with the you know, the mountain behind them. We haven't heard that one in a while.
I got so excited when it started to play.
Oh yeah, it's great. And then of course the track called Moving On, which is you know, right there at the end, and is the one that just really gets you every time. I mean, I would say that there's probably, like I said, at least 10 moments in this episode, but a lot of it is driven by Giacchino's score. And I think that's important. This is something that I've encountered specifically with Michael Giacchino. Like, for example, the Up soundtrack, which the Up score for Pixar's Up, the first like 12 minutes of that movie, obviously, is one of the sadder things that's ever happened in cinema. And I remember a couple of weeks after seeing the movie, walking to the mailbox at my apartment complex I lived in at the time and hearing the score and just like bursting into tears in the middle of the parking lot. And there are elements of the tracks in this finale that you could totally do that with. If you're just listening to them, you remember those scenes. You have that emotional muscle memory. And I think, you know, it's a testament to Giacchino being top of his game right there in that 2010 period. So shout out to Giacchino. He did an excellent job for most of this series, except for some of those names that we talked about in, I think it was like season five, where he got real
sometimes
lazy.
Sometimes he was tired. Yeah. Sometimes he was tired. It's okay. He did a lot of work.
Yeah.
It wasn't his job.
Here, Parallelocam is nowhere near the top 10 funny track names.
Our jungle of mystery moment, our final jungle of mystery moment, goes to just Desmond. Just why?
Why, Desmond?
Is he a weapon? Is he a tool? Did Jacob bring him here? Did this all play out like it was supposed to play out? Because it seemed kind of seated the pants there for a little bit. And then he just passes out. He's down a well. They move him, throw him down another hole, pulls a cork, passes out. Yeah. End of Desmond.
This cave is the ultimate Hume hole.
The cave is the ultimate Hume hole.
We thought it was the well, but no.
No, it was not.
Surely there's more holes to throw Desmond down.
He just always is trying to get close to that light. The dumb, elaborate artifact of the week is the cuneiform stone cork. What was it before there was a cork there? It seemed like the cork's important. I don't get it. The boon, Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award. We had many nominees. This episode, we have Locke taking a death tumble onto a cliffside. We have a whole bunch of jumping off cliffs. We have some falling down that takes place on the sideways, but we are going to give it to a fall down that takes place in the sideways. The Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to Boone Carlisle, who takes the fall to wake up his sister.
Nepotism.
Time's a flat circle. It was very important that we meet Boone Carlisle so he could teach us about gooping, about falling up the stairs and falling down the stairs. Boone had it all figured out.
Yeah. And then he woke himself up in the sideways.
He woke himself up. The John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award goes to Dr. Juliet Carlson, David's stepmom.
No, David's mom.
Real David's mom. Actual mom.
Jack's ex-wife.
Well, I mean, nobody gave birth to David, but David's mom in the Bardo.
Yeah.
David was formed out of things.
Shout out to that being what seemed like a very important mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the end and you're like, oh, David wasn't important.
Yeah.
he wasn't even real.
But I think it's a nice way to bring Juliet in right at the end. Mm-hmm. There's that great moment where she and Sawyer pass each other and you're like, ah! You know, she like gets in the elevator and you're like, ah! And I love the way that she and Jack interact with each other.
Yeah. When Jack's like, you'll love her. She's extremely pregnant. Yeah. I'm like, you guys.
They seem like they're friends, even though in the island timeline, Jack is kind of responsible for her death, but
sure, before Jack gets to be with all the women on the series and try them all out, but yeah, why not?
It's one of the reasons why people love Jack.
Guess I'm out of the book club. We got one, Joanna.
Oh, okay. Yeah. This is in depth. Can you come back to me on this one, actually? Because I need to have it in front of me.
Absolutely. Sure. The Abza Turtle Award in this one actually came up with Neil, and we bow to Neil's decision here. Neil, explain to us why the Abza Turtle Award do not appear on anybody's stomach.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, ultimately, this award is about celebrating someone who's just living their best life, being a hot person on the island. And I think it's long overdue and probably not. This is probably something we've talked about, but you know, we get Kate looking ripped with her great shoulders and arms on both the island when she's saving a bullet for the man in black. And, despite the fact that I think we agree that that dress is a little much, Desmond, in the sideways,
you creep.
There is that shot where she's about to deliver Aaron, where she just looks like Hulk Kate. And she's just like, my arms are ready to receive the Stardust baby.
The chosen one.
it's really great. Cause then everybody's crying and you forget about it.
It's been a couple of seasons, but Kate once again wins with all of her guns.
Yeah, Kate's guns.
Arm-based and otherwise.
Saved you a bullet.
The Through the Looking Glass Award, this is where we pinpoint people in the sideways looking into mirrors. It's not a mirror dimension, it's the afterlife. But hey, it does happen in this episode where Sawyer, during our parallelicam montage... looks into a mirror he punched, looks into a broken mirror.
Yeah, you could say that the sideways itself... becomes broken in this episode.
Yeah. The Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award. It has to still go to Ben. And then there's not a lot of lies in this episode, but there is Ben saying, what was that? Or what was what? When Locke asks what that was, and then he turns off his walkie-talkie.
When his pocket goes...
What was that? No, nothing? Nothing?
A bird. A hurly bird. What?
A hurly bird. You know those walkie-talkie birds. You know this island.
Yeah. You know that the man in black very easily fooled.
Spot the difference corner. This is where we spot the differences between the sideways and on island. In one place, they're all dead.
The other place, only Jack's dead.
Only Jack's dead. Our Jungle of Kistery moment. We're going to do one for the finale, and you will hear the result on next week's Lost-based episode. But this week, we get to figure out who's going to win in the What They Died For Kistery poll, where we decide who or what on the island needs to be kissing. Joanna, how did we do?
Listen, I actually didn't see it going this way. Even though I made the poll, I did not put my finger on the scale. Richard Miles and Sweat in the jungle, real low performer, I hate to say it, to our gray-haired boys. 8.1% of the vote. Dr. Linus Cocovan, nobody wants to see it. I got bullied into including this, but 17.2% of the vote. Democracy wins. Desmond and Saeed and Kate in the back of the van, you might remember they did the great prison break, 32.8% of the vote, but running away. Our podcast says ACAB, except for when it comes to kissing, it's buddy cops, Ford and Miles, Jim and Miles, 41.9% of the vote. I'm pretty sure Sawyer's coming back for a victory lap in the finale, but I'll let democracy speak for itself. You can decide who else you think deserves it.
If you're listening to this on the weekend it comes out, head to twitter.com/stormpodcast. Vote right now. See if you could prove Joanna wrong or right, depending on how you feel about it. Democracy apparently is going to speak. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award. It's going to go to our boy Jack, who definitely dies over a long period of time. But the last thing that he says on island is to Desmond, I'll see you in another life, brother.
My favorite thing that happened on Lostpedia for this episode is they're like, these are the last lines spoken on the island. It's like something Hurley says, right? And then right underneath it is another bullet point that's like, actually, the last words spoken on the island are Vincent going woof, woof. And you're like, okay, good boy, Vincent.
Actually, the dog gets the last
line. And Vincent, not eligible for the final words award because we have to assume that once he's on the island, he lives a very long life.
He lives forever.
He takes over Richard's job.
He'd be such a good boy at that. Think of all the files that he could carry around.
Absolutely.
So we have Hurley, Ben, Walt, Vincent. That's Team Island.
I mean, amazing.
Yeah, right? that's a pretty great Team Island.
Can we go back to book club real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so Haroon and the Sea of Stories by Salman Rushdie is a book that Desmond was reading in the season 6 premiere on the plane. And our pal Jeff Jensen has this description of what the book is about. Haruna is a self-aware fairy tale about a young hero whose name means Aaron, who has an adventure in a realm that happens to be the source of all stories. The conflict mirrors the Jack Desmond fake luck conflict in the finale. Haruna fights a monstrous shape-shifting man in black who seeks to destroy the sea of stories. The villain is a crazed control freak of a man who of science slash political tyrant who wants to put a cork in the wellspring of meaning itself and then spike the sea of story with a toxin of anti-story or meaninglessness. Haruna saves the day, and for his trouble, the administrators who manage the fantastical realm give him a happy ending. Haruna is slightly troubled by this. He feels his happy ending business is terribly contrived, yet he accepts the gifts anyway and appreciates it more and more as the benefits roll in. Love, hope, forgiveness, empowerment, redemption, reconciliation, restoration. In the end, and this is just my interpretation, Haruna decides to worry less about the origin of this windfall, an inexplicable palate drop loaded with yummy, nourishing soul food, and instead decides to worry more about living a life worthy of these eternal values. The mechanism of the delivery may have been contrived, but the values themselves are truthful and real. So it's a lot of Haruna here in the finale. Seed
the
planted.
Answers were there in the season 6 1 premiere book, finally.
Yeah, exactly.
The book was important. All right, hey, we have a returning quarter. It's been gone a little while, but Neil, where's Libby?
She's in the church.
Hey, Libby, you made it. through all the Daves.
Yeah, I think that she's one of two tailies that actually makes it. It's just her and Bernard at that point.
Oh boy. Remember when Kate sends Charlie for blankets? And I was like, oh no, Charlie, I hope you come back.
Remember how Charlie still messes it up, which I think is very on brand for Charlie. Like, he finds the blankets, but not the water. He's like, I got half of what you asked for.
He's like, I kind of tried.
Yeah. And they're like, it's fine. We're in the afterlife. We don't have to worry about it anymore.
The Frankel Pete's Guess We're Not Going to Guam Eggbake Award, unfortunately, in this last episode, gets renamed to what it always should have been, but it couldn't because it was in the calm, which is the Dr. Jack Shepard Falcon Punch Act Break Award. And that goes to Dr. Jack Shepard, who yells lock and then runs down the hill and then jumps at him. And then we cut in between parts 1 and 2 of the end. It's the act break of Lost, I'm pretty sure. Although they're coming right now. Rest in peace, Carl.
They're coming right now.
Still has a place in our heart. All right.
Does Carl make it into Ben's Bardo?
Oh.
I mean, I hope.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I really hope Carl, or Ben at least, thinks of Carl. Whether or not he gets to leave, like maybe Carl gets his own Bardo. But I hope someone remembers poor Carl. All right. I think that does it. For the ABC series Lost, Neil, what are we doing next week?
Well, Dave, we're going to take this opportunity to talk about Lost a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. Is this the last 2.5 hours weren't enough?
Yeah, so we're going to do, obviously, Joanna mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to field more of your emails. We'll do a sort of a Lost mailbag next week, and we have a couple more things planned for you in September. I really like this because, you know, when we started this podcast, it was on the heels of Game of Thrones, and we were so done with Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
That we didn't really take time to sort of like...
We were like, okay, simmer. Bye.
Well, time for Lost. Yeah,
and we had already dropped the first episode of our Lost rewatch before Game of Thrones even ended. So it's going to be nice to take a little time, unpack what we've seen, and hear more thoughts from y'all. And so, yeah, send us those emails, host@stormpodcast.com, and we'll get to them next week. It'll be fun and casual and... probably still the same length as this podcast.
Excellent. That means it's time once again for me to hit this sound cue. And we're going to start with Neil Miller this week so we could prime Joanna Robinson. Neil, where can people find more of your work online?
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects or at one perfect shot. And if for some reason you're not sticking around, any longer with the podcast and you're like, I don't want to hear mailbag, screw you. Be sure to subscribe to HBO Max this fall. There's a One Perfect Shot TV show that I'm executive producing that is a very real thing. So, you know, I'll be around. Don't you worry. And, you know, stick around to find out what our podcast is doing next, because even though we're not telling you, it's going to be something. So
we have to have like a Bardo.
Yeah, we got to get through our Bardo first.
Joanna Robinson, where could people find more of your work on the internet?
Not leaving. Moving on.
Yeah.
You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me on VanityFair.com, where I do a podcast called Still Watching. This week, we're talking about Nine Perfect Strangers. But next week, we're starting our coverage of American Crime Story, Impeachment. I am knee deep in the Clinton affair. It is going to be a time. So go check us out. Still Watching is the feed, and also Little Gold Men, where we talked about Ted Lasso Backlash this week. Anyway, so that's where you can find me. What about you, Dave?
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And here, saying, guys, welcome to the church. Thank you so much for supporting this podcast as we've gone all the way through Lost. It's definitely a different sort of thing than what we're used to doing, because all of the other TV shows we've been covering before have mostly been live. So the idea that we were able to go back to the show that we all loved and found all of you guys who also loved it too means the absolute world to us. And the fact that we were able to hopefully make these very difficult real lifetimes slightly better for some of you. If you were listening live, we went through some crazy stuff in America and the entire world. If you're just catching up on Lost sometime in the future, I'm sure that this podcast can help if you need an escape, if you need to go to the island of mystery, if you need to find some people that are going to make a difference in your life. We're here for you. Our fan base is here for you. Please be good to each other and don't get involved in white men's posthumous bullshit. Thank you.